Schuster Audio presents Tom Clancy's Power Plays, Ruthless.com. Created by Tom Clancy and Martin Greenberg. Read by J.O. Sanders.
The freighter had been christened the Kuan Yin, after the Chinese goddess of mercy. But what doubt can there be that its crew felt abandoned by their guardian spirit at the end? They had set out from the city of Kuching in eastern Malaysia at 8 p.m., the cargo deck of their 50-foot-long, half-century-old steamship loaded with palm oil and spices, tagged for distribution in the wholesale markets of Singapore. With little to do until they reached port, the four members of the loading crew were playing cards in the vessel's boxy hold by 9 o'clock, leaving the upper deck to the pilot and boatswain. The boatswain, a man named Qian Lo, had chosen to forgo the gambling and to remain on deck with the freight. Given his conscientious nature, he was understandably concerned the lashings might come loose in the strong ocean winds. Qian was standing with his elbows on the starboard rail, a cigarette dangling from his lips, when he heard a thumping sound off the quarter. Then, moments later, a second thump from the same general area. The Kuan Yin was now 20 nautical miles southeast of its destination, chugging along amid the scattered outcroppings of rock, soil, and lush tropical vegetation that were some of the Rau chain's smallest islands. Spread in clusters across a vast expanse of the South China Sea, they were mostly nameless and undeveloped, and Qian always found the passage between them to be a peaceful interlude before reaching the congested harbor of Singapore. He stared out at the water and considered ignoring the thumps until he'd finished his cigarette, but could not stop fretting. What if there were drums of unfastened cargo rolling and crashing about the deck? Qian shrugged and flicked his still-burning cigarette stub into the water. Responsibility had its burdens, he thought, and then turned to walk aft and check things out, unaware of the murderous presence that had slipped aboard the vessel. 15 minutes earlier, two Zodiac inflatable watercraft had glided from the rushes and mangrove roots rimming a tiny islet some 40 degrees east of the freighter's bow. Fitted with stabilizing fin rails and powered by sound-baffled 90-horsepower outboards, they planed across the water at close to 50 knots, fast enough to eat up the Kuan Yin's lead in minutes. There were 12 men in the pirate gang, its leader an Iban tribesman of huge proportions, the rest natives of the southern islands, their number divided evenly between the fast-moving inflatables. They had identical Chris-knife tattoos on the backs of their hands as symbols of their criminal brotherhood. They were equipped with assault rifles and carried daggers and scabbards at their waists, and they were ready to put their weapons to lethal use without compunction, as the expressions of cold malignity under their face masks might have shown. As the silent-running Zodiacs approached the stern of the Kuan Yin, they veered off in separate directions, the head man's craft swinging toward its port side, the other angling to starboard, both of them slowing to match the larger vessel's speed. Alongside the Kuan Yin's hull, the head man slipped his mask into place, jerked his head toward a short, wiry man with a rope ladder on his belt, and sliced his hand through the air, signaling him to proceed with the raid. The smaller man nodded, reached down between his knees and grabbed a 20-foot rope with a bear claw grappling hook at its end. Stepping down on the rope's bitter end, the man turned toward the cargo ship and heaved the grappling hook up at it, letting the weight of the hook carry the line on, the rest of the line outward. The iron hook clamped onto a gunwale with a solid thump. An instant later, the thrower heard a similar noise from the opposite side of the freighter, and exchanged an anticipatory look with his four companions. All of them knew that sound meant the other raiding party had also been successful in mooring their Zodiac to the Kuan Yin. Having climbed the rope ladder ahead of the other men, the thrower crouched on deck. He heard the bosun's footsteps a split second before he actually pivoted on his haunches to see him approaching. By then, he decided what to do. The man had to be taken out right away. Qian Lo had halted several yards toward the fore of the deck, staring at the invader in shock and dismay. Suddenly, he broke from his paralysis, spun around, and ran for the vessel's bow. where he knew the pilot would be manning the bridge. But the smallish pirate's swiftness and agility were good for more than just climbing. He sprang to his feet and streaked after Tian, whipping his knife from its scabbard, moving almost silently despite the thick-soled boots he had worn to provide traction while boarding the freighter. He overtook the bosun in a flash, lunging at him, grabbing him from behind, locking his arms around his chest, the force of his tackle throwing him belly down onto the deck. Tian produced a little bleat of pain and fear as a hand twisted itself into his hair and yanked his head up and back. Then the hard, cold edge of the pirate's knife met the soft, warm flesh of his throat and sliced it open from ear to ear. The pirate rose to his feet, dragged Tian's body to the edge of the deck, and kicked it overboard. When the pirate returned to where he'd tied the ladder to the handrail, he found that the rest of his team and five of the men in the other raiding party were also on deck, waiting for the last pirate to complete his climb. A moment later, he was up, and they were all racing toward the forward part of the ship.
"Get on your knees, hands behind your heads!"
the Iban pirate chief shouted at the ship's hands, now gathered together below deck.
"Do it now! I kill you all!"
The four men complied, making no attempt at resistance, getting up in such a rush they clumsily knocked over several chairs. They knelt in the middle of the cramped little hold and looked at the raiders in silence. The pirate chief's eyes moved over the faces of the sailors. While they looked tense and anxious in the cast of an overhead light fixture, none of those faces seemed especially fearful. And why should they? The men were seasoned hands. They would have been through hijacks before and expected to be robbed and sent off safely in dinghies and lifeboats. That was how it usually went. The poor, stupid bastards hadn't any idea what had happened to their mate up above. The Iban waved over one of the pirates who had come rushing down the stairs at his heels. The man stepped up to him and leaned in close for his orders.
"I don't want their papers messed up, Joao," the Iban warned. "That happens. All this is for shit. You understand?"
Juara's affirmative grunt was muffled by the dirty white towel shrouding his mouth and chin. He gestured briskly to a couple of the other hijackers who moved toward the kneeling seamen and ordered them to toss everything in their pockets onto the floor. The ship's hands did as they were told without challenge. Juara then turned to look at the Iban headman.
"Get it over with."
One of the ship's hands opened his mouth to scream and started to his feet. But then the raiders triggered their weapons and he fell backwards, his clothes riddled with bullet holes, most of his head blown away. Swept by the hail of gunfire, the rest of the Kuan Yin's crew also went down in a cloud of blood, bone, and tissue, their arms and legs sprawling out wildly in their final throes. The big Iban waited for the guns to stop their racket, then stepped over to the card table and randomly lifted a wallet from the pile of items that had been taken from the crewmen. He opened the wallet and found a driver's license in a transparent plastic sleeve. There was more identification in the other compartments. The slain crewman to whom the wallet had belonged was named Amnon Jafari. The Iban made a low, pleased sound in his throat. He hoped the sailor had lived his life fully and spent his money well. At any rate, his wallet and identity now belonged to someone who would make good use of them. There were big things in the works, very big, and the Iban was eager to reach Singapore and get cracking. He thought of the sheet of paper folded in his breast pocket, thought of the instructions that were written on it, thought of everything they were worth to him, surely more than he'd made in any dozen hijacks. The American, Max Blackburn, didn't stand a chance, no more than the crew of the ship had stood one. Not the slightest chance in the world. Charles Kirby looked at his client Roger Gordian a while and then drank some of his scotch and soda. It was 9 o'clock at night and he was exhausted and jet-lagged after a long flight from New York. Still, he had joined Roger in the book-lined study of his San Jose home because he'd felt the news he was carrying was too important to wait until morning. Gord not only paid the law firm of Fisk, Kirby, and Toland a handsome retainer for their advice and representation in corporate affairs, but was also a close personal friend. When Kirby had learned that the Spartus Consortium, Uplink International's largest shareholder, intended to sell off its 20% interest in the company, he'd immediately known what it augured, and had decided to fly out and tell Gordian about it face to face. Studying Gordian's troubled features, he knew he'd made the right decision.
"Chuck," Gordian began, "for God's sakes, I want to know how I could have been blindsided. How I could leave myself open to having somebody try and grab Uplink right out from under my nose."
Kirby drained his scotch, lowered the glass, and rattled the melting ice cubes inside it.
"You want me to sit here watching you bash away at yourself, Roger?"
"Look," Gordian said, "I've established my organization in dozens of countries, placed my employees at extreme risk in some of them, lost good people in others. If I can't learn my lessons, can't compete when the stakes are high, I shouldn't be fooling around in the big leagues."
Kirby sighed. Granted, they were looking at a very serious problem, but Gordian ordinarily wasn't the sort of man to let self-pity and defeatism through the door, no matter how hard they tried shoving their way in. What the hell was wrong with him? Could this be a kind of delayed reaction to the encryption tech controversy? A case of the psychological bends after finally coming up from leagues underneath it? Kirby thought about it a moment and supposed that might be the case, considering how long it had dragged on and the flack Gordian had taken because of his public stance against the new government export policies. And yet he couldn't help but feel that something else was eating away at him as well.
"I won't deny you were vulnerable, but why blame it on recklessness?" Kirby said. "You've had a lot of strains on your financial resources lately, ranging from outlays that were merely unavoidable to others you couldn't have anticipated without a crystal ball."
Gordian's peremptory look told Kirby he didn't need to be further reminded. There had been the huge price tag of manufacturing, launching, and insuring the constellation of low-Earth orbit K-band satellites needed for Uplink's orbital telecommunications network, the multi-million-dollar cost of rebuilding the Russian ground station after it was nearly leveled by a terrorist attack the previous January, and the simultaneous expenses of getting the ground stations in Africa and Malaysia fully operational. An ambitious program of corporate initiatives, to be sure. But Gordian's diversification from the defense technology that had earned him his fortune was not essentially profit-motivated, and that had always impressed the hell out of Kirby. More than anything, Gordian had a heartfelt desire to help create a better world, and believed to his core that the problem of eliminating global tyranny and oppression required communication-based solutions. Having grown up in an era of Berlin walls and iron curtains, he was convinced that nothing had done as much to bring those Cold War barriers down as information seeping through their cracks. Information, he believed, was the ultimate key to personal and political freedom. His goal, his vision, was to provide that key to the broadest number of people he could imagine.
"Make no mistake, Chuck. I'm not second-guessing my business decisions with regard to the company's expansion. But I do fault myself for not preparing a defensive strategy against a shark attack. And it isn't as if I haven't had good counsel. You've advised me time and again to implement staggered terms of office on the board of directors. My friend Dan Parker, the congressman, tried to persuade me to lobby more forcefully for specific anti-takeover legislation in the state. I did neither."
Gordian
raised a hand to silence him.
"Hear me out, please. This isn't just a mea culpa. A minute ago, you said something about my needing a crystal ball to predict what's happened. Well, in a way, I had one. I don't think Sparta's putting its stake on the market comes as a total shock to either of us. Look at the articles in the Wall Street Journal, the endless commentaries on those CNN and CNBC financial programs. Every aspect of my company's operations has been subjected to criticism and ridicule, a great deal of it originating from a single source. Is it any wonder the value of our stock has gone into the sewer?"
"For the record, my comment related to your expenses, not the devaluation of Uplink shares," Kirby said. "But I agree that the great and exalted financial prophet, Reynold Armitage, has done a trash and burn number on you in the media. If he's the source you're talking about, that is."
"None other."
Gordian folded his hands on his knees.
"Sparta's panicked, and I can't really blame them. Tell me the truth, Chuck. Have you ever seen anything like Armitage micro-analyzing our 10K information on the air, and then putting such an incredibly negative spin on it? Because I find it damned curious."
Kirby didn't say anything, just shook his head. Yes, Armitage was an expert securities analyst, able to sniff the wind for market indicators better than almost any of his peers. But what had raised Armitage's campaign against Uplink to an inexplicable level of viciousness was the timing of his disclosures. The very day Uplink had released its yearly report to stockholders, Armitage had gone on Moneyline with the firm's 10K and charged that there were critical discrepancies between the two statements. That had been untrue. Armitage had exaggerated the significance of every expense, minimizing every gain, juggling profit-loss ratios to depict a company on the verge of ruin. Curious behavior. Damned curious indeed.
Guardian, do you believe this takeover bid was orchestrated?
Kirby asked.
That Armitage has been going at you with the intention of destroying shareholder confidence and...
And provoking a sell-off, Gordian nodded. This whole thing reeks of behind-the-scenes manipulation. Kirby inhaled, exhaled.
If that's true, it would at least suggest that Armitage is in somebody's pocket.
The two men faced each other soberly, their eyes holding.
You have any idea who that somebody might be?
Kirby asked. Gordian sat there quietly while the antique clock across the room ticked off a full minute. No, he replied at last, hoping his sincerity would be accepted without challenge. He was, after all, lying through his teeth. Fat Bees, a decadent hole in the wall tucked away behind a rotted shophouse facade in a narrow Geylang district larong, was unquestionably the seediest bar on the island republic of Singapore. The bar's owner, Fat B, who was not fat at all but physically slight, had gained a reputation for being a bold exclamation point of a man through a mixture of conspicuously non-Singaporean aggressiveness and flamboyance. Those who had business dealings with him also knew of a certain hard, forbidding look that became evident in his eyes when his anger or suspicion was aroused, giving him at such times the appearance of a wary crocodile. Tonight, Fat B sat at his usual table in the rear of the bar, his back to the wall, keeping a watchful eye on every coming and going at the door.
Here's what you came for, Xiang.
He slid a brown manila envelope to the big, long-haired man seated opposite him.
Odd how so much effort goes into providing such a slim package. But it's just that way when you're trading information. It weighs nothing and everything at the same time. La.
Xiang just looked at him, then silently reached out for the envelope and lifted it off the table. Fat B tried not to show that he'd noticed the crisp tattoo on the back of his hand, thinking his interest wouldn't be at all appreciated. Not by this retrograde brute. Xiang unclasped the envelope, folded back its flap, and looked inside. It contained a stack of 9 or 10 photographs. Reaching in with one hand, he pulled them out just far enough to expose their upper borders and then gave them a quick scan, riffling their edges with his thumb, ignoring the sheet of paper clipped to the last snapshot. Then he returned them to the envelope, closed the flap, and looked back up at the barkeep.
Who's the girl?
It's all in the little fact sheet I enclosed. Her name is Kirsten Chu, and she's employed by a company called Monolith Technologies. Very attractive, don't you think? It's unfortunate her parents stuck her with a Western name, but I believe she was born and educated in Britain. So it goes.
Xiang stared at him, his eyes flat.
You know what I mean. I didn't expect there to be two of them.
Listen. She's just a beautiful lure dangling at the end of a very short line. You understand? Her movements are easy to track. Stay on her, and she'll lead you to the American.
What's their connection?
I don't ask. Our employers don't tell.
She a national?
Fat B waited a moment before he replied.
Don't make more out of this than there is. It isn't that big a deal.
Bullshit! You think I'm stupid? An American with no business being in this country disappears. It's one thing to clean it up afterward.
But a citizen? A woman? You've got to be joking. Something goes wrong and we're caught. I can look forward to a lot worse than six strokes of the rotan.
Fat B chuckled.
In Singapore, a fellow with my habits and appetites is liable to receive that sort of punishment just for getting out of bed in the morning.
Xiang looked at him with his dark, empty eyes, but said nothing.
Really, what's the problem?
Fat B said.
If you can grab both of them alive, fine. But it's this Blackburn who's truly valuable to our employers. Your main concern with the woman should be making certain she isn't left behind as a witness.
If this is so easy, why couldn't your people take care of it? They followed her, they took the pictures. They could have gone ahead with the next step.
We each have different ways of making ourselves useful. This country is where I live, you understand? I'm here for the long term. You're in and out. La.
Fat B shrugged again.
Let's not waste any more breath discussing it. We're both already committed, after all.
Xiang was silent for a moment.
All right, the pirate said at last. But I'd better get the rest of my money as soon as it's done. You better make sure of it.
Fat B looked at him with quiet malice.
Of course. It will be my pleasure.
The two men regarded each other a moment without exchanging another word. Then Xiang stuffed the envelope containing the photos under his denim jacket, pushed his chair back from the table with his feet, got up, strode to the entrance, and departed. Blackburn had picked up the puppet at an open-air bazaar. This was a while back during Diwali, the Hindu festival of lights. Needing a break from his responsibilities at the ground station, he had taken a few days off and gone to the coast to enjoy the frenetic celebration, taking in the sidewalk dancers, musicians, and magicians, sampling the delicious curries and satays, browsing the craft stalls, and just strolling at his leisure amid the exuberant banners, floral decorations, sprays of colored rice, and endless strings of candles, lamps, and light bulbs brightening every door and window. Blackburn remembered the strong scent of exotic spice on a vendor's breath as he had stepped up close to make his pitch, a pair of two-dimensional leather puppets in each hand, waving them aloft on slender rods. He remembered their painted colors looking gaudy and brilliant in the midday sunshine, remembered the exquisite detail of their hand-tooled features, and most especially remembered admiring the workmanship of the one in the vendor's left hand. The one that had, in fact, first caught his eye and was now hanging above him on the wall of his office. Some sort of animistic figure, part elephant, part man.
50 ringgits, $25 American.
The man had been shouting as he manipulated the puppet over his head. Out of curiosity, Blackburn had stopped to ask the vendor which Hindu deity the puppet represented, speaking English because he had not yet become proficient in Bahasa, having been in Malaysia less than a month at the time.
It's Ganesha, son of Shiva.
The voice was female and carried a musical British accent. Blackburn had turned to see an Oriental woman of perhaps 30 or 35, a strikingly beautiful woman with a sweep of angle-cut black hair, slanted brown eyes, and skin that had been tanned the color of almonds and cream in the perpetual August of the tropics. Wearing summer khakis, a loose cotton blouse, and sandals, she was carrying a Coach handbag over her shoulder, a bag he'd known must have cost more than the combined yearly income of everyone living in that village. Blackburn remembered immediately noticing that she had a magnificent body. Even through her baggy clothes, he'd been able to tell.
One of your best assets in the field, he thought now, 3 months later, his face troubled, his inner voice edged with self-contempt.
Sitting by the phone in his office, he couldn't remember whether the desire to go to bed with her and the idea of convincing her to become a fly on Marcus Kane's wall had been linked from the very beginning. Oh, he'd felt a superficial attraction right away. But when had he ever met a good-looking woman he hadn't thought would be fun in the sack?
A god representing man's animal nature, she'd continued.
He looked at her and smiled. Sounds like the perfect mascot for my office.
You'll see his image on a lot of pendants and charms, she said, returning his smile. They're worn as protection against evil and bad fortune.
Better than perfect. Think I'll hang him right over my phone for when the boss calls to check up on me.
Her amused grin had broadened. I can tell you the asking price is quite fair. A lot of time goes into making these Weiyang Kulit puppets, at least the quality ones. This man's puppets even have bison horn rods.
Blackburn looked into her dark brown eyes and realized she was studying his own. They stood there silently a moment, facing each other, their eyes still in contact, the crowd jostling around them, the pungent smell of cooking smoke thick in the sultry air.
50 ringgits, $25 American.
The vendor yelled at the top of his lungs, pushing up closer to them, obviously worried that he'd been forgotten. Blackburn paid for the puppet. The vendor tipped him a little bow of thanks and briskly moved off into the crowd.
Well,
the woman said,
I'm sure the puppet will make an interesting conversation piece when you bring it to work with you. Don't see many like it in the States, I'll bet.
Actually, my pal Ganesha here won't be leaving the peninsula in the foreseeable future. Guess I should properly introduce myself. My name's Max Blackburn. I work security for a company called Uplink International. And right now, I'm based at our regional headquarters in
Johor, isn't it?
She suddenly burst out laughing as they shook hands, putting him at a loss as to what he could have said that was so funny.
I'm sorry. You must think I'm awfully rude.
I'm Kirsten Chu, and it happens that I work for Monolith Technologies Singapore, the corporate communications division. I'm here on holiday visiting my sister and nieces. Our employers are very much arch rivals, aren't they?
For the past 6 months, I've done nothing but huddle with our lobbyists and publicists about the encryption flap, brainstorming ways to counter Roger Gordian's opposition.
Though Blackburn would not realize it until several months later, that was the moment he had decided to use Kirsten. The exact moment. It had been a calculating, unemotional decision, entirely separate from the genuine attraction he felt toward her. And all the time they had spent together since, all the nights their bodies had been locked in passion, using her had been very much a part of it.
Well, judging by how badly things are going for us, you're doing a hell of a job. But does being on opposite sides of a professional dispute mean we can't make friendly overtures?
I suppose, she said, it could be possible.
And let's seal it over dinner tonight.
She looked at him a moment longer, smiled.
Yes, I'd love to have dinner with you.
And that was that, the beginning of an affair that had turned out to be enormously satisfying for him. Great sex, great inside information. Now Blackburn sat in the silence of his office, his face troubled, looking out his window at the sprawl of low prefabricated buildings that constituted the Johor ground station, hating to think of the danger he'd put her in. He reached for his phone, dialed her office number, waited for her secretary to connect them.
Max, she said, picking up a moment later, did you get my messages?
Yeah, sorry I couldn't get back to you till now. They're adding components to the alarm system and I had to oversee the whole thing. Took me most of the morning to get the glitches smoothed out.
Her voice became hushed.
Guess I got a little anxious. Something's turned up, and I think it could be important. Perhaps the very thing you've been looking for.
You better not say any more right now. We'll talk about it in person. Barring any unforeseen developments, I'll be taking a lorry over the causeway tomorrow morning.
Bringing along your overnight bag?
It's been packed since yesterday.
Not too full, I hope. Clothes won't be necessary for the weekend agenda I've planned. I have to run, Max. Love you.
Blackburn's eyes moved from the window to the spot where he'd hung the puppet on the wall.
I love you too,
he heard himself say, and wondered if the words sounded as empty and mechanical over the phone as they did to his own ears.
Congratulations, Alex. I bet every political columnist in the country's writhing in the light of your greater glory.
Alex Nordstrom smiled a little uncomfortably as he walked into the conference room,
hoping Gordian's comments coupled with his late arrival wouldn't give rise to certain impressions about him. That they might be accurate impressions was beside the point. Why be blatant? Conceit was a quality Nordstrom preferred to bear with discretion. He had an old Harvard classmate who'd been wearing his Phi Beta Kappa fraternity key on a gold fob for the past 20 years, and it was never a pretty sight.
"So you've heard about my upcoming submarine ride," he said, taking his place at the table.
And how was that for understatement? Or had he struck a false note right there? Maybe it was a mistake trying to appear blasé about being one of a half dozen members of the press who'd been hand-picked to participate in the maiden run of a first-of-its-class Seabolt. A submarine ride during which the president and several other world leaders would be aboard, hoping to milk a treaty-signing event for all the public attention it was worth. Yes, maybe he ought to let the others in the room be freely awed.
"May I ask, who gave you the news?"
"My source insisted on anonymity," Gordian said. "Anyway, Alex, you'd better pour yourself some coffee. We've got a lot to talk about this morning, and you just might feel like you're already underwater before we're finished." A workable segue to more relevant matters of discussion, Alex thought. He looked around the room, nodding his acknowledgement to the parties who'd arrived ahead of him. Most of the faces he saw were very familiar, belonging to Gordian's core group of friends and advisors. There were two uplink employees at the table besides Nordstrom himself, who, as foreign affairs consultant, was technically a freelancer. Vice President of Special Projects Megan Breen, seated to Gordian's immediate right, and Risk Assessment Manager Vince Skull at his left. Directly across from Nordstrom was Dan Parker, the congressman from California's 12th District and Gordian's closest confidant since the days when they'd flown bombing sorties with the 355th Tactical Fighter Wing in Vietnam. In a chair alongside Parker sat another government official, Robert Lang, chief of the FBI's Washington, D.C. Bureau. The man poring over a document at the far end of the table was Richard Sobel, founder and CEO of Secure Solutions, a young Massachusetts-based encryption tech outfit. He both rounded out the small group and, by mere virtue of his presence, symbolized all the reasons it had come together this morning. Nordstrom couldn't have said whether it was more significant that a competitor in the field of cryptographic technology was here to offer Gordian his support and alliance, or that Sobel was the only one of 50 leaders in the software business to accept Gord's invitation.
"Okay, let's get rolling," Gordian began. "First, I want to be clear about how much I appreciate why you've come. It obviously would have been easy to remain silent and invisible. Our unified stance on the encryption issue has already caused most of us considerable problems, and it's a fair bet they're going to increase exponentially in the next couple of days." He paused and glanced over at Megan Breen. "The credit for putting together the statement I'll be reading at our press conference goes entirely to Ms. Breen. Assuming everyone received a copy by fax and has gotten a chance to review it, I believe you'll agree she's done a magnificent job of boiling our concerns down to media-friendly sound bites." Megan smiled at the compliment.
"While Roger may have put it a bit too flatteringly," she said, "I did want to make our comments brief and straightforward. We have 48 hours before President Ballard signs the Morrison-Fiore bill, which gives me ample opportunity to fine-tune any part of the statement that needs it. I think, though, that our message really is a simple one."
"Looks that way from where I sit, too," Vince Skull growled, apparently on the verge of an angry eruption.
"We put the crypto out overseas without restrictions. Presto, every bad guy with a computer link can buy himself electronic communications that law enforcement can't crack. If Ballard's got the high-wattage brain they say he does, he ought to be able to understand that without any problem."
"Our purpose," Gordian broke in, "should be to make sure we haven't overlooked any means of staying passage of Morrison-Fiore, or effectively presenting our case to the public, the government, and the rest of the industry." Nordstrom had been thinking precisely the same thing.
"I'd say reading our little declaration to the Washington Press Club on the day of the signing is perfect strategy. It will stir up controversy, grab media attention, take a story that would otherwise appear on page 9 of the dailies and put it right on page 1 above the fold. As to throwing some last-minute hurdle in front of the bill, short of locking the president out of his office the day after tomorrow or conspiring to break his writing hand, I honestly don't see how it would be possible.
Any ideas, Dan?
Gordian asked.
I opt for breaking his hand,
Parker said, but Gordian could only manage a feeble approximation of a smile in response. Parker suddenly became aware of the silence around him, realized Gordian was still waiting for his answer.
From a political standpoint, I think we ought to be looking ahead to the next session of Congress. Take a hard line now to gain a public relations edge. Advocate a return to the Clinton administration's policy of setting firm limits on the level of encryption software that's authorized for foreign sale, and perhaps ease toward some compromise as things pick up again in the Hill,
Gordian said, completing Dan's thought.
I like it.
So do I,
Lang said.
As it reads, I believe Morris and Fiore will be calamitous to our national security. But certain changes could be incorporated that would mitigate its damage. Say, a clear-cut provision banning export of plug-in encryption cards and critical components for multiplex encoding units like the type used by our armed forces, the same type you and Mr. Savelle are refusing to market abroad.
Another thing would be a tough set of international laws and standards managing the operation of key recovery centers,
Parker said.
These places are essentially private banks where governments deposit the digital key codes to their data scrambling software. Right now, police and intelligence agencies can subpoena the banks to turn over the codes, although the civil libertarians are challenging that power in various courts.
He looked at Lang.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but my understanding is there are no effective international treaties which would compel a key recovery center in one country to turn its keys over to another, even if the nation requesting them can prove they're needed to counter a threat to its security.
Lang nodded.
You're dead on. A terrorist with sophisticated electronic equipment could theoretically cripple our economy, even disable our military computers, while the ambassadors are wrestling over what legitimately can and can't be done under existing cooperation agreements.
Gordian ran his eyes around the table, letting them settle briefly on each face, each member of the coalition that had gathered around him.
We should discuss our travel arrangements for the trip to Washington. I think we're ready for the next round.
The second time they'd been together, the first was that crazily exciting weekend in Selangor when Max Blackburn swept into Kirsten Chu's life like a whirlwind, swept her into bed before she had a chance to think about what she was doing or even ask herself whether anybody was at the wheel in her swoony little head. The subject of Marcus Kane's business ethics had come up in their conversation. Actually, Max had brought it up. Over dinner at a Thai restaurant on Scots Road, she recalled. They had finished their meal and were on their second bottle of claret, and a half hour later would be grappling breathlessly in Max's suite at the Hyatt, the clothes they had shed, leaving a scattered trail to the door. In between, though, they had drunk their wine and discussed her employer. Briefly, it was true. Very briefly, because they'd both been looking forward to more delightful activities than talking shop. But long enough to touch off a sequence of events that would eventually turn her world inside out. Kirsten glanced at her wristwatch and saw that it was 5:45, almost time to be off. Max was meeting her outside the Hyatt in half an hour. She popped the disk that would be the instrument of her professional demise out of her computer's CDR drive, and for several moments afterward just sat there shaking her head, staring at the lethal circle of plastic, remembering that conversation at the restaurant as clearly as if it had occurred only yesterday.
Ah, Max, Max, Max.
The question he'd posed to her was fairly indelicate, whether she had any strong feelings about her employer's underhanded corporate tactics, as if it were an obvious given that there was something wrong with the manner in which Marcus Kane did business. The sky is blue, the sea is wide, Marcus Kane is an unscrupulous crook. Elementary, my dear Kirsten.
Well, I'm sure that's his reputation among sour grapes competitors and his adversaries in protracted political battles,
Kirsten said more sharply than she'd intended. Charming as he was, Max's cockiness had irritated her.
Otherwise?
Actually, Kirsten, I was thinking of the class action lawsuit against him a couple of years back,
Max said.
You remember it?
As one among an army of publicists who'd worked to stem the tide of bad press arising from that affair, Kirsten had remembered it all too well. The problems occurred when Monolith began patenting and marketing software which developers claimed was nearly identical to the beta programs they'd sent out for evaluation. Their charge was that Kane's techies had lifted their intellectual properties, made minor changes to their graphic interfaces and proprietary architecture, and then stamped a Monolith logo on the retail packaging. In essence, that Monolith had rapaciously stolen their products and sold them as its own. Sitting across from Max in the restaurant, Kirsten had put down her glass and leaned forward, her arms folded on the table.
You certainly must know the matter was resolved out of court, she'd said.
With a huge cash settlement from Kane.
That isn't the same thing as an admission of guilt. When you're a public figure, it's sometimes worth a great deal to get an issue out of the spotlight.
Max had spread his hands.
There are other bones to pick with Kane.
She'd looked at him with an odd mixture of consternation and amusement.
Tell me, Max, do you extend your services to Uplink for free, troubleshooting around the world like a knight errant in Roger Gordian's holy crusade to link all of humanity with cellular phones and wireless faxes?
If not for Max's frank, earnest look, what he'd said next might have caught her altogether by surprise. As it was, it instantly made her regret her sarcasm.
Roger Gordian is a great man, and I would lay down my life to protect him.
Whammo. Now, looking back to that night, she recalled nearly being blown off her seat by those words. Somehow, their incredible strength and conviction bulldozed through her remaining emotional barriers and caused her feelings for him to soar toward honest-to-God romantic love at warp speed. That had been a new and startling emotion for her, and she hadn't quite known how to handle it. A voice from the doorway suddenly intruded on her thoughts.
Oh, excuse me, Miss Chu, thought everybody go home. Come back later or no?
Kirsten had identified the cleaning woman by her singlish even before she looked up to see her head poking through the door.
No, Lynn, that's okay.
She clicked her computer into its preset shutdown routine and turned it off.
I was just wrapping up here.
The door opened wider and Lynn clattered in with her cart.
Why you work so late, La? It's Friday night. Where your handsome American?
Kirsten smiled, reached for her briefcase, and put the CDR into an interior pocket, right beside the digital audio recorder on which Max would find a little something extra that was bound to make him ecstatic.
Actually, the handsome American and I are planning to meet at his hotel and then dance the night away at Harry's, she said.
And as far as she was concerned, drink it away, too. After turning the information she'd uncovered over to Max, information which might bring down a company that had been more than generous to her with its professional advancements, and that the group-centered Eastern traditionalist in her insisted was deserving of her loyalty come hell or high water, she would need a whole lot of something potent to wash away the bad taste in her mouth.
You have nice time,
Lynn said, a grin breaking across her broad face.
Promise, tell me about it Monday, la?
Kirsten snapped her briefcase shut.
As much as I can without shaming myself.
Blackburn hastened up Scott's Road toward the Hyatt. It was 7 o'clock in the evening, but the sun was only beginning to lose some of its solid-feeling intensity. Kirsten was waiting at her usual spot beside the main entrance, her hair pouring loosely over the shoulders of an eggshell-colored dress, looking out into the busy one-way thoroughfare, probably expecting him to arrive with a steady stream of cabs and buses moving past the hotel. As he approached her, Max instantly felt the mingled guilt and desire that always swelled up in him when they met. She had given herself to him without inhibition, and in its own way his craving for her was equally fierce. But Max did not love her as she had come to love him. And he had told her that he did only because it forwarded his selfish objectives. And though his lies and manipulations had profaned even their moments of greatest intimacy, he knew that he would keep leading her down the garden path until he got what he wanted, and that it wouldn't even be that hard.
No, God help me. Not hard at all, he thought, stepping quickly toward where she was standing.
Xiang sat behind the dashboard of a panel truck outside the Hyatt service entrance on the uphill side of Scotts Road. Less than half an hour earlier, the truck's original driver had been delivering fresh linens to the hotel. Now his naked corpse was in back, wrapped in a red-stained tablecloth. The white uniform blouse that had been stripped from his body had smears of blood on the collar and was almost impossibly snug on Xiang. But he felt confident no one would notice it while he remained in the truck. Still, he was growing anxious. Where was the American? He could not stay parked at the loading ramp indefinitely without arousing suspicions. On the street, the rest of the strike team had assumed various positions around the hotel. Two covering its doors, a pair in front of the Royal Holiday Inn complex across the street, another four dispersed between the north and south corners of Scotts Road. The woman had been standing at the Hyatt entrance for some time, looking out at the street as if she expected someone to join her at any moment. And of course, that was exactly the case. They had been stalking her for days like wolves on the hunt. Tonight, she would draw their real quarry into their circle, and they would do the job they had been paid to do. Now the woman chanced to look in the direction of Orchard Road, and her eyes widened. The watchers took note.
Max,
she called, descending the hotel steps. The watchers moved in to take them. The subtlest of visual cues jacked Blackburn to heightened alertness. The man who had triggered his reaction had been poring through a magazine as he waited at the bus stop. So why had his eyes flicked over the upper edge of the magazine as Blackburn walked by? Why, all at once, had Blackburn gotten the powerful sense of being watched? Perhaps 20 yards ahead of him, Kirsten was starting down the stairs in front of the Hyatt's entrance. Max slowed his pace and pulled back his gaze. He ranged it from right to left across an area several feet away and parallel to him, then reversed direction, scanning a larger, farther sector until it once again encompassed Kirsten. Blackburn marked the bodies of the people within eyeshot as stationary and moving objects, drawing correlations between their positions and the broader patterns of foot traffic, scouting for any peculiarities in their interrelationships. Several were readily apparent. There was a man launching off the curb directly across the street to his left, beyond the pedestrian crossing, then weaving through traffic toward his side of the street, a rare sight in a country which punished jaywalking with steep fines. Another was advancing from a short distance up the sidewalk, shoving through the crowd. Two more were rapidly converging on the hotel from opposite sides of the entrance. Blackburn snapped a glance behind him, felt the skin on the back of his neck prickle. The man he had passed at the bus stop was pushing toward him, the magazine he'd been holding no longer in evidence. All four of the men were around the same age, Asian, and wearing the same basic style of clothing. It was clear now that he had walked into a trap, a closing trap. He did not know for certain who his enemies were, how they were deployed, or even their total number. But he did know the positions of five of them. He walked on, trying to control his nerves, making a tremendous effort to conceal the fact that he'd spotted his attackers. Kirsten came down the steps now, the men nearest the hotel closing in on her, which could only mean they, or whoever had sent them, knew something about the monolith files. He had to get her away from them.
"Hi-ho," she said, taking his hand in hers. "I see you finally."
"Don't talk. There isn't time."
He took her by the arm and led her forward. Kirsten stumbled along uncomprehendingly for several feet, letting Max steer her forward. She glanced over at his face as they approached a cab stand, her eyes bright with distress, their cheeks almost touching.
"Max, dear heaven, Max, I..."
"Shh."
What followed would always be a blur in Kirsten's recollection. One instant they were together, she under his arm, Max practically carrying her along, and the next, he'd shoved her into the back seat of the cab and was standing on the street, standing there alone, leaning through the door from outside.
"Selangor!"
he shouted at the driver. The man behind the wheel jerked around to look at him through the safety partition.
"Sorry, no long distance, la,"
he said, shaking his head. Blackburn jammed a hand into his pants pocket, hurriedly yanked out his billfold, and tossed it onto the front seat.
There's more than 200 American dollars in it. Take her, and it's all yours.
Kirsten was gaping up at him with a kind of helpless desperation. The driver, meanwhile, had already lifted the billfold off the seat and was peering into it with astonishment.
Max, I don't understand, she cried. What's happening? Why aren't you coming?
Stay with your sister. If you don't hear from me in a few days, I want you to get in touch with a man named Pete Nitt.
Max felt a hand seize on his left elbow from behind. He tensed, trying to keep himself planted between the two attackers and the cab.
Get moving!
He screamed into its interior, then pulled his head out of the door, slamming it shut with his right hand. He could see the reflections of the two attackers in the window, one still holding on to him, the other trying to scramble past him to the car. For a seemingly endless moment, the cab remained stationary, and Max was sure the driver wasn't going to bite at his offer. Then he saw him push down the lever of the meter to start it running, and expelled a sigh of relief. Her face bewildered and terrified, Kirsten shifted around in her seat as the taxi angled from the curb, staring at him through the rear window. Their eyes met briefly, his narrow and resolute, hers moist with tears, and then the taxi joined the heavy flow of northbound traffic and was gone. It was the last they ever saw of each other. Max heard a short, frustrated breath escape the man that had taken hold of his right forearm.
You come with me, Kambing,
he hissed and tightened his grip, his lips against Max's ear, his body pressing up behind him. Max didn't budge. The man's partner had jogged after the cab for several yards, then been forced to get out of the way of speeding traffic, scrambled back onto the sidewalk and turned around, but he hadn't yet returned to where they were standing, which left Max with a small but workable opening. Moving with reflexive swiftness, he jerked free of the man and glanced up and down the street. The magazine reader was coming at him from the left, and now he had the jaywalker for company. A third member of the strike team was hustling toward him from the right. Counting the man he'd just shaken off and the man who had been chasing the cab, both of whom were behind Max, the odds against him were at least 5-1. The only direction left open was straight ahead, toward the hotel. He ran across the sidewalk and bounded up the stairs to its entrance. Max cut a line through the lobby without a backward glance. He was acquainted with its layout from his regular stays in Uplink's long-term guest suites, and he knew what he was looking for. To the rear of the desk and main lounge area was a bank of elevators, and on their right, a short, straight corridor leading to a service entrance. Beyond that, a stairwell which would presumably take him down to the basement and loading doors. Max moved past the entrances to the hotel dance club and bar, past the elevators and over toward the service entrance, still not looking back over his shoulder. No time for that. No time at all. Max turned the knob on a gray metal door with his left hand, pushed the door open with a flat of his right, went through and stepped from the carpeting to bare concrete. Blackburn took a hurried look around. Narrow flights of stairs ran up and down from where he stood on a wide landing. He descended the stairs and got as far as the lower level when a huge man in an ill-fitting delivery uniform entered. Before he could think twice, the delivery man's massive hand swung out at his temple, and the world exploded into blinding whiteness, and then went black. Although it wasn't yet time for the reception to conclude, Marcus Kane was feeling bored and stuffy-headed in the packed United Nations chamber. From his place at the dais, he sat staring past exotic floral arrangements at a profusion of television cameras, cables, floodlights, and microphone booms, all manipulated by a crew of scurrying technicians. Behind him was a large collapsible backdrop showing the UN symbol, a globe viewed from the North Pole and surrounded by olive branches. Because this was a UNICEF event, there was the added touch of a woman holding a young child in the center of the globe. Kane's wife, Odile, sat quietly at his right, her face thin and clamped. On either side of them were officers of the organization's executive board and high-ranking members of its parent body, the Economic and Social Council. Below him, rows of interpreters and headsets were translating their insipid, windy speeches into 6 languages. The speaker presently delivering an encomium to Kane's humanitarianism was Amnon Jafari, executive secretary of ECOSOC, and he seemed about to wrap things up. A group of dark-suited men had appeared from behind the collapsible wall with a 6-foot-long blow-up of Kane's endowment check to UNICEF. $3 million, which he'd promised to double once it was matched by donations from other wealthy individuals. The mock check was backed with plywood, and there were 2 members of the group holding it at each end. The secretary's voice was a deep tenor, and its volume grew as he ended his speech, expressing his gratitude to Kane with a final burst of enthusiasm. Kane heard his name boom from Jafari's lips to the acoustical drop ceiling, and then carry across the chamber to the VIP floor and public galleries. Applause crashed through the room like thunder. He rose, went to the podium, and clasped Jafari's right hand in both his own. Then the secretary stepped aside and he turned to face the crowd, the oversized reproduction of his check making a splendid prop behind him. He began his comments by thanking the roster of UN officials responsible for the event, speaking without reference to notes or the teleprompter. Kane's eidetic memory was one of his strongest assets.
"Yes, I am honored to be here. But more than anything, I am grateful for the opportunity to stand before you today with a challenge. As many of you know, I have long been committed to extending the global reach of interactive electronic media, and especially internet technology. For it is my belief that they are the modern magic that can unite the inhabitants and governments of planet Earth and truly make us one. The tools that will bring about our next evolution as a species. Cyberspace allows us all, young and old, rich and poor, the great and the humble, to meet on a level field. A field with ever-expanding horizons and limitless potential."
Kane went on in that vein for perhaps 10 more minutes and then decided to quit before he talked himself hoarse. His standing ovation was punctuated with cheers and bravos, but the show wasn't over yet. Not until his Southeast Asian business associates, his benefactors, as they would have preferred to be considered, saw him run through his greatest hits. Doubtless they would be watching and listening for them in front of their television screens. Kane stood quietly until the crowd subsided and announced that he would be taking a few questions from the press corps. Predictably, the first one shouted at him had nothing whatsoever to do with his gift to UNICEF, or his challenge to the rich, or his crusade to put the deprived youngsters of the world online.
"Mr. Kane, as you know, the Morrison-Fiore bill will be signed into law the day after tomorrow. Could you please give us your thoughts about that, and also about the fact that Roger Gordian is expected to simultaneously hold a press conference in Washington to declare his continuing opposition to the president's relaxed encryption policies?"
Kane looked thoughtful.
"I respect Mr. Gordian for his tremendous past accomplishments, but he has already expressed his views on the subject. And the people have voiced their grassroots opposition through their elected representatives. This is about our children and our grandchildren, about the future. Regrettably, Mr. Gordian has turned his eyes in the opposite direction."
"If I may follow up, sir, do you believe there's any link between Roger Gordian's stance on the encryption issue and Uplink's diminishing stock values?"
Beautiful, Kane thought.
"That's a question better asked of an investment banker than a software developer. I'm really not here to speculate on my colleagues' business difficulties. But, if I may argue the obvious, the fortunes of any technology firm rise or fall on the willingness and ability of its leaders to look ahead rather than behind them."
When Max Blackburn first told Pete Nimick that he'd gotten a line deep into the working guts of Monolith, and that he was using it to trace what he described as improper business practices and financial arrangements, Nimick had listened with close interest, and by not ordering him to abandon his investigation post-haste, had tacitly okayed its continuance. Still, as chief of security at Uplink, he had cautioned that Uplink would under no circumstances be dragged into a situation that might be perceived as corporate spying. The potential liabilities were far too great. Nimick had also pointed out that it would be inadvisable for Max to provide any further details about the probe should he decide to move ahead with it on his own string, unless or until he turned up something of concrete significance. Max had gotten the gist without anything more having to be explained. Deniability had been established with a nod and a wink. Officially, that had been the end of Pete's involvement in the fishing expedition. Unofficially, he had been eager to see what developed, and was becoming increasingly so as Marcus Kane's public attacks on Gordian intensified. After reviewing an expensive upgrade Max had proposed to the infrared matrix last week, Pete had decided to give him the green light to begin installation, only to learn that he hadn't yet arrived at the office.
"Mr. Blackburn was in Singapore for the weekend," his receptionist had said, "and it's quite possible he's run into delays getting back across the causeway. Would you like me to try contacting him on his mobile?"
"No, it isn't anything urgent. Just tell him I called when he gets in." That had been 8 hours ago, and Max still hadn't been in touch. Nimick wondered if his message had somehow gotten lost or slipped Max's mind, and wanted to try him one more time before turning in for the night. Pete went over to his desk, picked up his phone, and keyed in Max's number.
"Uplink International, Max Blackburn's office."
"Joyce, it's Pete Nimick."
"Oh, hello, sir," she said, and then hesitated with a beat. "Mr. Blackburn hasn't shown up yet."
Nimick was silent a moment. There had been something odd about Joyce's tone from the moment he'd identified himself, and now he suddenly realized what it was. She was covering.
"Joyce, maybe it's my imagination, but you're sounding very protective."
She cleared her throat.
"Sir, Mr. Blackburn was rather vague about his plans before he left. But, to be truthful, I think they were of a personal nature."
"You think he's cozied up somewhere with his girlfriend, is that it?"
Perhaps. I mean, not that he specifically told me."
"Your loyalty to Max is admirable, but besides your suspicion that he's gone off on an amorous toot, are you sure he's not keeping anything from me?"
"No, sir. Absolutely nothing."
"Then let me know as soon as he materializes."
In South Kalimantan, Indonesia, Zhu Sheng rowed in a canoe in silence, looking with steady fascination at the other vessels winding along the canal. In addition to market craft, there were postal boats, water buses, and tub-like rice barges with sailcloth tops wobbling toward docks at the city center. It was a scene that brought back memories of his last visit to this district nearly 3 decades ago, when Sukarno's PKI was at its height of power and had sought to establish a united communist front with the government in Beijing. He had come then as an official envoy of Zhou Enlai to help organize state construction projects, a straightforward assignment for a man whose revolutionary passion was still in full blush. Like many things in life as one became older, the circumstances of his present trip were laced with greater complexity.
"Pelan, pelan saya,"
Zhu told his canoe guide in Mandarin-accented Bahasa. He pointed toward a woman selling rice cakes from a boat that had been cobbled out of warped old boards. The canoeman cut his motor, paddled up to the rickety boat, and reached down beside him for a bamboo pole with a nail fastened to one end. Extending the pole across his bow, he speared a rice cake for Zhu Sheng and held it out for him to sample. Zhu took a bite, swallowed, and tossed a bronze-colored coin under the vendor's deck.
"Terima kasih banyak,"
she said, smiling with gratitude. Zhu instructed the guide to restart the outboard and settled back for his light breakfast. A short while later, the canoeman turned a bend in the canal, swung toward a house and rice barn overhanging the near bank, and informed his passenger they had reached their destination. Zhu did not bother saying that he'd already guessed it for himself. The further they had progressed beyond the market, the more he'd sensed eyes watching from behind shuttered windows and noticed hard young men tracing his progress with quick, covert glances from the walkways connecting the ramshackle structures on the banks. Cao Luan was like a feudal lord to the people of this area, giving them just enough to keep them loyal, but not so much that they might become independent of him. Zhu waited until the canoe had been lashed into a berth composed of 4 vertical bamboo poles, then paid the guide, lifted his carryall onto his shoulder, and rose to step ashore. Zhu ascended a shaky ladder, half expecting it to buckle under his feet. He was met at the entrance to Cao Luan's home by a pair of lank, brown-skinned islanders with undulant, crisp tattoos on their hands. Was it not said that such a dagger could claim a victim merely by being driven into one's shadow? Perhaps so, Zhu thought. But ancient myths aside, he believed the semi-automatic rifles slung over the men's shoulders would prove much more lethal.
Welcome,
one of the guards said, bowing his head deferentially. Zhu nodded and went inside. The interior of the dwelling was a large rectangle, its floor and walls made up of bare plywood boards, the high-peaked roof supported by tiers of slanting beams. Zhu ran his eyes over to the middle of the room where the men had come to meet. General Kursik Iman, Nya Kambera, and the drug trafficker Cao Luan were waiting at a long plank table. Glancing up from a conversation with the others, Kursik was the first to acknowledge his presence.
Zhu Sheng, you look well,
he said, dipping his head.
How was your trip? Hot, tedious, and hopefully worthwhile.
A smile touched Kursik's thin, lined face, while the eyes below his shaggy brows were as strong and sharp as ever. By contrast, Zhu thought, Canberra looked scarcely older than a child, political subversive, champion of the poor. His soft features and vain demeanor put the lie to it, though, as did his social position. The eldest son of a diamond baron, Nya had been born into immeasurable wealth and handed control of Banjarmasin's largest bank only to serve as a place marker on his family's sprawling financial game board. He understood nothing of human struggle and less of material hardship. Nor did the spoiled upper-class activists with whom he secretly consorted, and whose national reform movement he was helping to fund.
So, Asti,
Luan said,
my place isn't nearly as well-appointed as Kursik's residence, but as a humble exile and outsider, it's the best I can do.
Seated at the head of the table, Luan raised his hands in the traditional Thai greeting, palms together as if in prayer, his fingertips just below his nose to indicate familiarity. On their previous meeting, Zhu noted, he had steepled his hands lower and closer to his chest. The stranger's why? The significance of the gesture was not lost on Zhu, and it admittedly distressed him. But was a man not measured in large by his associations? Still, he returned it without hesitation. The time for misgivings was long past.
Please,
Luan said, indicating an empty chair on his right.
Make yourself comfortable.
Zhu went over to the table and regarded him carefully.
The American, where is he?
Luan nodded toward the door in the right wall.
My friend Xiang and his sea wolves are keeping a close eye on him. As yet, he's been unable to communicate this morning. But I expect he'll be coming around shortly. Maybe then we'll all learn what we want to know.
Zhu darted a surprised glance across the table at General Kursik.
He was captured, what, 3 days ago?
Kursik brought his head up and down a slow nod.
He's a tough one. No need to be concerned. We'll get what we want out of him soon enough,
Luan said. He smiled thinly.
The White Lady has her ways.
Zhu raised his eyebrows.
Heroin? They've scarcely been apart since we introduced him to her yesterday,
Luan said.
She'll charm him into talking.
They were quiet for a moment.
What I think ought to worry us is the woman,
Nya said. Zhu shifted his attention to him.
Chu, is that her name?
Kirsten Chu. She's dropped out of sight, and there's no telling what she's discovered about our involvement with Monolith or what sort of proof she's taken with her.
I assume we have people looking for her in Singapore?
Zhu asked.
Still, Nya said, it could hurt us badly if the Americans learn of... I've been trying to assure Nya he's jumping ahead of things,
Kursik interrupted.
Let's stay with what we know. This could have been a case of industrial espionage, having nothing to do with us. She's repeatedly accessed Monolith's most sensitive financial databases from her office computer terminal, Nya said. Made dozens of phone calls to the uplink ground station in Johor, and probably many more that can't be traced because they went to your line. Are you suggesting that we simply forget about her?
You really must try to become a more receptive listener,
Kursik said.
Without the American to guide her, it's likely she won't know where to turn or what to do with any documentation she might have. Probably she'll surface on her own. If not, we'll eventually find her.
He motioned toward Zhu Shang with a slow, gliding wave of his hand.
Let us put our speculation aside and get to the point of why our comrade has traveled here.
Zhu nodded slightly.
I brought positive news. Those I represent are prepared to supply whatever munitions you require. The high-speed boats will be more difficult to obtain, but should also be forthcoming.
And the landing craft?
Kursik asked.
You'll have to settle for fewer than requested.
How many?
3, perhaps 4.
Kursik pinched the bridge of his nose.
The assault rifles, they've never been fired?
Zhu knew what he was thinking about their integrated silencers, which quickly became ineffective with use.
They're factory new Type 85s.
Kursik continued to look thoughtful.
We must be guaranteed prompt delivery. As you know, our window of opportunity is quite small.
Any date we agree upon will be firm, Zhu said. You have my word.
Kursik nodded with satisfaction.
I hope, Zhu said, that none of you will object to the terms of payment.
Luan pursed his lips, reacting with predictable wariness.
Which are? I'm obliged to require the full sum in advance.
What?
Nya said, his eyes flashing incredulously.
You can't be serious.
Zhu remained very still.
We are asking for a great deal on short notice. The suppliers have expenditures of their own. It is reasonable for them to expect hard currency in return for the risks they are taking.
And what of our risks? Nya said. I've done much for you and the Zhongnanhai you represent. My bank's international position could be irreparably damaged if things go wrong.
Enough,
Kursik interjected.
I understand your frustration, Nya, but we are compelled by certain exigencies and must acknowledge that our needs are rather special.
He glanced at Luan. What do you say? The Thai hesitated a moment, then shrugged his chunky shoulders.
Attached as I am to my money, I nevertheless consider my portion of the expenses already spent, and suppose it makes little difference when I physically part company with it. Let's not bicker over what can't be changed, and instead move on to important matters of planning. We've been so focused on Sandakan and what comes after that none of us are talking about the data storage vaults in the United States. They are essential to our success and at least as highly guarded as...
A door opened, surprising them. They fixed their attention upon Xiang as one of his pirates leaned through from the other door, addressed him in a low whisper, then withdrew into the barn, leaving the door ajar. Xiang turned back around, looking straight at the Thai.
The Americans opened his eyes.
The room went silent. Luan smiled slightly and cast an eager glance around the table.
Excuse me, brothers,
he said, heaving his bulk off the chair.
I have to go to work.
He followed Xiang into the barn, pushing the door heavily shut behind him. Blackburn came to with a start. Disoriented, bathed in sweat, clusters of black motes floating across his vision. His eyes were battered and swollen, his body throbbing with pain in a dozen places. Where was he? He realized he was in a chair, slumped forward in a hard, straight-backed chair, and jerked to an upright position. Too quickly, dizziness washed over him, and his stomach contracted. He fought to push back the nausea, the taste of vomit rising in his throat. For several seconds it was touch and go, but then the sickness began to recede. He squeezed his pulsing eyes shut and sucked in breath after labored breath. His shirt was bloody and torn. Had he been shot? No. No, he didn't think so. There had been a bad tumble in the hotel stairway. Max gulped down another mouthful of air. With each interval of consciousness, more of what had happened came back to him, his scattered bits and pieces of memory weaving into a coherent thread and drawing him toward a full recognition of his predicament. Here in the barn, he'd been asked questions, mostly by the one who seemed to be in charge. Luan was his name. asked questions and beaten hard when he refused to answer. But that hadn't been the worst of it, not by far. He had been through brutal ordeals before and believed he could have withstood their interrogation for quite some time. The hairs at the back of his neck prickling, he remembered the needle. How could he have forgotten it even for a second? Maybe, though, that was why his mind had switched itself off for a while, to provide a cessation from what was otherwise unavoidable, to spare him from thinking about the needle. Blackburn was still taking stock when he heard movement to his right. He looked up and saw one of his guards, he'd counted four of them in the dimness, step over to the door on the opposite wall, open it, and then lean out to speak with somebody on the other side. When the guard came striding into the barn a moment later, Luan was right behind him.
Here we go again, Max thought, steeling himself.
He watched in silence as Luan moved to a table about 6 feet away where his captors kept the heroin and works, as well as a water pitcher and small gas burner for cooking the drug. He saw orange flame spurt from the burner, saw Luan drop a chunk of the heroin into a spoon, then saw him mix it with some water and hold the spoon over the heat. After perhaps a minute of boiling, he dropped a cotton swab into the spoon, let it swell up with liquid, pushed the needle into it, and raised the plunger to filter the narcotic solution up through the cotton.
My friend, you have kept your secrets against much persuasion, but sooner or later, you must tell me what I need to know,
Luan said, approaching with the hypo.
I already know who you are and who you work for, leaving only one thing unknown. What were you after, Max Blackburn?
Silence.
Tell me.
Max kept staring at Luan in silence. The Thai's face had grown sorrowful.
It shouldn't matter to me, but I want to give you fair warning. While you may not remember how to use your tongue at the moment, it is certain that you will before I leave here. You understand?
Max swallowed dryly. No, maybe he didn't understand. Not altogether. But he had an awful feeling that he soon would. Finally, Luan pursed his lips and discharged a sighing breath.
No, I don't think you're going to take my advice after all.
He turned partially toward one of Blackburn's watchdogs and nodded. Max glanced over the table and felt his stomach tighten. The watchdog had raised his knife to the flame, was holding it over the flame, its blade rapidly heating up, becoming radiant in the dimness of the barn.
Xiang,
the Thai said. The big man turned and advanced on Max, the knife flashing red-hot, almost seeming to pulse in his grip. Out the corners of his eyes, Max saw two other guards suddenly appear from the shadows, one on either side of him. Each clasped a shoulder and pressed it hard to the chair, pinning him against the backrest. He strained against them, but their hands were as unyielding as the steel cuffs on his wrists. In no hurry, Xiang hung over him a moment like a living, breathing mountain. Then he lowered the kris knife to his arm and sliced into his skin about an inch above the wrist, making a shallow, razor-thin incision that almost instantly withered around its edges from the heat of the blade. Max was seized with pain as Xiang carved into him, gliding the knife upward beneath his skin, stripping it away little by little, pushing the blade higher, higher, higher. Squeezing the chair's armrest, Max fought not to scream, clenched his teeth so he wouldn't scream, a raspy, wounded animal sound tearing out of him instead. His head whipped back and forth. He smelled the sickly sweet odor of his own cauterized flesh and nerve tissue as it peeled away from the rising blade. He thrashed convulsively, heard the legs of the chair pounding the floor, banging on the floor, the loud thump of wood against wood matching the jerky violence of his spasms. Max only realized the cutting had stopped some 30 seconds after the Thai ordered it done. He thought it must have taken longer than that for Xiang to actually slide the knife out of his arm, flicking a long shaving of skin to the floor. Finally, the guards who had been holding him down backed off and he sagged into the chair, gulping down huge lungfuls of air, the muscles of his ravaged arm twitching and jumping. He felt his consciousness draining and willed himself back to clarity. Luan's face hovered in front of him.
Your employer, Roger Gordian. Tell me what he wants.
Max sat there, motionless. Rivulets of sweat poured down his brow and stung his eyes. His arm felt coated with scalding oil. Luan showed him the syringe.
Tell me, he said. I can make things better for you.
Blackburn met his gaze, inhaled, exhaled, and then gave him a slow nod. Luan grinned and leaned in expectantly.
My boss is P.T. Barnum, and I'm looking for freaks for his tent show. Got 'em all here. A fat man?
He nodded toward the tie.
A giant?
Nodded toward Xiang.
And more geeks than you can count.
He rotated his head to indicate the guards standing on either side of him. Luan's grin turned downward and mutated into something horrible and forbidding. He straightened, allowed the full weight of his gaze to press on Blackburn for a moment, then slowly shook his head.
Stupid,
he said, and then gave Xiang a command in Bahasa, pointing at Max, pointing at his face. Blackburn saw the giant take a step toward him with the Chris, the two watchdogs who'd restrained him once more appearing at the fringes of his vision. He thought about how to prevent them from carving him up alive, decided there was probably nothing he could do, and figured he would try anyway. Summoning what strength he had left, Max threw his weight forward as hard as he could and managed to rock to his feet while still cuffed to the chair. His wrists chained to the armrests, the back of the chair a rigid plank against his spine, forcing him to bend at the waist so he was almost doubled over.
Gonna get hurt no matter what I do, he thought. Might as well dish some hurt of my own.
Whirling toward the giant, he lunged forward in a bullish rush, Xiang's torso looming up like a marble pillar as he drove in and butted him with his head. Xiang snorted in anger and surprise. Then he growled, actually growled, and took a broad step forward and placed his huge hands on both sides of Max's head and pushed him, chair and all, against the wall. Then, with a tremendous heave that bulged the muscles of his upper back and shoulders into a corded mass, he slammed Max backward with stunning force, pulled him in toward his chest again, slammed, pulled, slammed. Lost in a roseate haze, Blackburn felt a snap somewhere in his neck, followed by a bright sparkle of pain. The haze darkened and solidified. From what seemed like a great distance, he heard the Thai shout something in an agitated voice, in a language he didn't understand. He had sensation of disconnected freefall, as if he were a small stone plummeting into a bottomless chasm. Then he ceased to feel anything at all.
Stop!
The Thai clambered across the barn toward Xiang and grabbed his arm.
That's enough lunacy!
The giant Xiang glanced over at him. An instant later, his face changed, the furious, wildly unreasoning look clearing from it. He turned toward the limp form he was pressing to the wall, stared at it a moment as if seeing it for the first time, and let it drop. Luan knelt over Blackburn and hurried to check his pulse. He didn't like the way his head was leaning, the rubbery tilt of his neck. When his eyes jumped up to Xiang, they were glacial.
He's dead.
Every weekday morning at 5:30, Roger Gordian left his home outside San Jose, got into his raven black 1984 Mercedes SE, then headed east along El Camino Real to San Carlos exit and through the downtown area to Uplink's corporate headquarters on Bonita Avenue. There were a number of things on his mind, things he needed to sort through without interruption, and the driver's seat of his car was the ideal place to do precisely that. The night before, Gordian had gotten his call to war from Chuck Kirby, who had phoned to confirm what he'd already known in his gut, and what legal disclosure requirements would reveal to the public within days. The tender offer for the Spartus holdings had been made by Marcus Kane, through a rather thinly disguised corporate surrogate, specifically a Midwestern concern called Safetech. Okay, next item, he thought. Having established what Kane wanted, the issue of why grew clear. A takeover seemed the obvious objective. How then to anticipate it? Kirby and his trustbusters were already formulating a civil action on the grounds that there were several sectors of the communications and technology industries where Marcus Kane's various interests were in direct competition with Uplink. The lawsuit was a showstopper in that it would keep the lawyers and judges wading through a sea of complicated litigation. But unless the feds climbed aboard with a criminal antitrust suit of their own to bolster Uplink's challenge, something they were typically slow to do, it would result in a long battle of attrition with unpredictable results. Gordian eased into the left lane. Quite unexpectedly, his mind had turned back to the piece he'd read by Reynold Armitage in the Wall Street Journal the other day. What was it he'd had to say about Gordian's resources? The lead-off essentially had been a rant about his corporate diversification having led to wrong-headed management decisions. The article had prickled, but could it be Armitage had a point? Gordian hesitantly had to admit that he might, and suppose part of his irritation over what he'd read stemmed from his having realized it from the beginning, if only on a semi-conscious level. He could not afford to let his disdain for Armitage, or suspicions about his motives, prevent him from intelligently evaluating his assertions. Emotionalism in a fight was blinding and corrosive. Regardless of its ultimate merit, his enemy had unwittingly given him a tip worth exploring. And if it turns out he's right, what path does that take me down? Gordian thought, knowing full well that wasn't the question he needed to ask himself. The path was there before him, its direction clearly marked, and what he really had to learn was whether he'd have the strength and will to walk it and accept the painful sacrifices to which it would inevitably lead. Kirsten stood looking at her sister in the kitchen of Anna's home in Petalingjaya. Her face pale, Anna was trembling with distress.
"Anna, please listen to me," Kirsten said now, fumbling for words. "I'm so sorry." "Sorry?"
Anna emitted a burst of harsh, pained laughter.
"What am I supposed to say to that? What am I supposed to do?"
Kirsten was shaking her head.
"I don't know," she said. "All I can tell you is that I never intended to bring any of this into your home, and that coming here was a terrible mistake. I'll be out by tonight, if it's what you want."
"Shit, will you stop making things worse?" Anna said sharply.
"Bad enough you've been lying to us the entire time you've been here, letting us believe you're nursing a broken heart. Then I hear it's all about you being involved with spying on your employer, and this craziness about men ambushing you on one of the busiest streets in Singapore like something out of James Bond. And now, to make matters worse, you're saying goodbye, as if you think we'd be eager to see you walk out of the door and get kidnapped, even killed, God only knows. I'm not sure whether to be angry, frightened, or insulted."
Kirsten felt her throat getting thick with moisture and swallowed.
"May I request that forgiving be added to your multiple choice?"
Anna held her gaze for a long, silent moment. The silence grew.
"Yes," she said, finally nodding. "You may."
Kirsten expelled a ragged sigh.
"I'm so mixed up, Anna. Max, he knows my cell phone number and promised to be in touch within days. When I got into the cab, he was starting to give me someone's name, a person to call if I didn't hear from him, but I didn't catch it. Kirsten, if you want my opinion, the people you ought to be calling are the police," Anna said. "This Max is the one who got you into trouble in the first place. I understand that you have feelings for him, but how do you know for a fact that he isn't a criminal, that the men who are waiting outside the hotel weren't the authorities?"
Kirsten shook her head vehemently.
"No, it isn't possible. But you've only known the man a few months. Why are you so positive? Because while I may be 5 years younger than you, I'm not some little schoolgirl who's got her head screwed on backwards,"
Kirsten said, her throat filling again.
"Look, I won't deny I'm in love with Max, nor will I deny having had doubts about whether he shares that feeling, or even wondering on occasion whether my position at Monolith made me useful to him. But I know he cares for me.
He risked his life to lead those men away from me. I can't just turn my back on him now.
Anna stood beside her in silence, looking at her, taking her hand. Meeting her sister's gaze, Kirsten leaned forward and kissed her gently on the cheek.
It's time for me to take some advice besides my own, she said. I'm calling the police.
You want to what?
Charles Kirby said, gripping the telephone in his Broadway office.
I can't believe you're serious.
Believe it, Gordian replied from clear across the United States. I've given some hard thought to the idea. Sometimes it's a matter of recognizing when you've got a genuine inspiration.
Our paperwork for the antitrust suit's already 3 inches thick,
Kirby said.
We're almost ready to file it.
Then go ahead and do so, Gordian said. We both know its real purpose is to buy time, and we can use all we can get. Kirby frowned.
Gord, my job is to give you legal counsel and representation. I can't make decisions for you, but I hope you're aware of the risk you'd be taking by going ahead with this.
I can accept it.
All right. Just tell me you won't lock yourself on this plan until after you're back from Washington.
I'd rather get things in motion sooner, Gordian said. As a matter of fact, I was going to ask that you head out here to meet with me and Richard Sobel the morning before we fly.
But that's Thursday, the day after tomorrow,
Kirby said, flipping through his appointment book.
I'll obviously understand if you can't make it, Chuck. Just as long as you understand that if you have any compelling reasons to dissuade me, it'll be your last chance to offer them.
Reaching for his pen, Kirby crossed a Thursday lunch date with a very attractive female colleague out of the book and substituted the words, to San Jose. Just as Alexander the Great severed the Gordian knot with a swift and decisive whack of his sword, thereby gaining the favorable auspices of Zeus, so had Megan Breen and Peter Nimick concluded early on in Uplink's worldwide expansion that it needed a similar rapid response capability, a security team which could cope with crisis situations where both regional stability and the company's interests were threatened. Sharing intelligence with host governments, using scenario planning techniques to defuse most problems before they hatched, and prepared to counter violence with forceful action of its own should that option be unavoidable. Since their employer had been cooperative enough to have a surname and bold disposition that invited comparison with the legendary Macedonian, they had dubbed this arm of their far-flung organization Sword. One of the most impressive young Turks with Sword's New York branch, Noriko Cousins, had been a hand-picked member of Nimick's team during the codename Politica investigation of about a year back, and was credited with being a major reason for its speedy progress and successful resolution. After her section chief, Tony Barnhart, took early retirement due to injuries sustained during that probe, she had been a natural to fill his post, which, in keeping with Pete Nimick's loose-reined executive approach, allowed her to run her show with very little topside interference. She rarely heard from Nimick unless it was important. And so when she got back from lunch this cool autumn afternoon to find 3 phone memos from him on her desk spindle, every one of them received during the hour she'd been out of the office, it struck her as safe to interpret the repeated calls as a sign that a matter of some urgency had cropped up. Hustling over to the phone, she punched in his direct number without pausing to unzip her jacket. He answered at once.
Nori, I've been anxious to hear from you. Is everything all right, sir?
I haven't decided yet. Look, I'm not going to twist your arm, but I'd like you to come out to San Jose and would rather not explain why until you get here.
When? She said.
Soon as possible. Tonight, tomorrow, if you haven't got anything else that's pressing.
Nothing that my assistant can't handle. Let me get off the phone and start making arrangements. I'll get back to you as soon as they're set.
Later, then. And, Nori, I suggest you pack plenty of lightweight clothes. We might be doing some traveling.
She rubbed the back of her neck, thinking that one over.
Curiouser and curiouser.
Will do, sir.
As with any deadly combustion, the Jakarta massacre was inevitable once its explosive ingredients made contact under flashpoint conditions.
According to reliable estimates, the throng of protesters was nearly 5,000 strong at the height of the rally, and their complaints ranged from the dead serious to the frivolous. There were men with signs denouncing repressive social policies, demanding industrial privatization, and decrying the lack of variety offered by their cable television servers. There were women campaigning for better educational opportunities, new laws to prohibit workplace discrimination, and the scarcity of cosmetics due to import bans. There were journalists of both sexes crying out for freedom of the press, urbanites lamenting the absence of reliable public transportation, suburbanites complaining about their neglected roads and highways, and environmentalists calling out for the emplacement of stricter pollution controls. There was even a small but vocal group of gourmands expressing outrage over the recent closings of several four-star restaurants. While fewer in number than the demonstrators, the military troops deployed to manage and contain them were clothed in body armor and equipped with a wide range of weapons and crowd suppression gear that gave them a considerable defensive and aggressive edge. They also had a dirty little secret up their collective sleeve. Plainclothes security agents pretending to be demonstrators and dispersed throughout the crowd. The infiltrator's job was to incite a confrontation with the troops, who of course knew of the plan and would respond with a swift and violent show of force against the real protesters. To make things look good, the first staged incidents were kept at the level of pushing and shoving matches, the protesters getting increasingly out of control, the soldiers showing restraint and discipline in driving them back. The clashes gained in frequency, following a realistic pattern of escalation, and soon the troops were being pelted with rocks and bottles. Tear gas grenades, pepper spray, high-pressure water hoses, and riot batons were used to subdue the rock throwers, who were dragged from the scene in hand and leg cuffs. Next, several of the undercover plants at the skirmish line began hurling gasoline bombs, covering the area with orange splashes of flame and dark clouds of acrid smoke. The troops smashed into the crowd from all directions, letting loose with their heaviest firepower. People trying to flee were trapped in the press of bodies and fell screaming and crying, swept with gunfire, slipping on their own blood, crawling through pools of blood. The television crews already on the scene were speedily joined by satellite crews that could provide live coverage of the melee. Watching the event closely on television, Nya Canberra couldn't decide how to feel about it. He had poured a fortune in rupiahs into financing the demonstrators, caring nothing about most of their issues but liking to play political games with the government, largely because he resented the competitive advantage held by the president's businessman relatives. Still, Nya found the rabble crude and undeserving of sympathy. Would the crackdown play to the government's advantage or further inflame its domestic opposition? And what if the International Monetary Fund withheld the balance of its economic recovery package, or even aborted it entirely in a knee-jerk spasm of humanitarianism? What effect would such a turn have on the Canberra's family holdings? And most perplexingly, why hadn't he asked himself that before? It was all very confusing and intimidating, especially when he stopped to consider that his involvement with the students would only be the beginning. The very tip of what would surface if someone started digging around in his affairs, and that his complicity, however indirect, in the killing of the American spy could be the very thing that led to where his secrets were hidden. If Max Blackburn's employers began tracing the circumstances of his death, it would inevitably lead to Nya's own door. How then to preempt such an investigation? Yes, Marcus Kane eventually would be feeding on Uplink, devouring Uplink. He was confident of that. But the process of consumption would take time, too much time. Nodding to himself like a man who has suddenly realized the solution to a complex puzzle, he picked up the telephone and called Marcus Kane.
Hello? Marcus, hello. I'm actually surprised I was able to catch you at home. According to what I've been reading, you're the toast of the town these days.
Kane raised an eyebrow at the sound of Nya's voice. He'd been in front of his television for over an hour watching raw CNN satellite feeds of the Jakarta bloodbath.
Libertine that I am, I occasionally give my follies a rest and try catching up with the news, he said, wondering if the timing of Nya's call was any coincidence. Speaking of which,
What's this madness going on in your country?
Our beloved head of state is clamping down on his opposition, it seems.
Does that distress you?
Kane heard Nya sigh.
I suppose it depends on how these events come to bear upon my own fortunes.
Kane's eyebrow arched a little higher.
As long as your bank continues doing well, I imagine you'd be in a good position regardless of who comes out on top.
Marcus, listen to me,
Nya said after a moment.
We have to talk about Roger Gordian. Something's arisen that could have damaging implications for us unless it is addressed right away.
Kane stroked his chin, thinking.
Does this have any connection to the son of a bitch who was nosing around my Singapore branch? I thought you took care of him.
A pause.
The one you speak of is dead, and that's where the complications begin.
Kane suddenly realized his heart was beating fast.
I don't understand. I mean, what went wrong? And what does it have to do with me?
How it happened is a long story, but be assured it wasn't intentional. Really, though, abducting him was a mistake, and I objected to it from the beginning. Had he been released, he would have been able to share information about his captors with the authorities and his employer. His death, meanwhile, is surely going to bring about an investigation. In the end, what is the difference? People are going to want answers, and all roads lead in our direction.
Wait a second, Kane said. You're speaking as though I had a hand in this. Your friends came up with a brainstorm of taking him when there had to be an easier way to find out what he was looking for. Now you fucking deal with the rest, whatever it may be. I've repaid your loans 10 times over. I've done everything you asked, like a fucking indentured servant. But this, I want no part of it.
Another pause, this one of a longer duration than the first.
Marcus, I needn't remind you that you've already participated in activities that would be considered treasonous offenses by your government. If your actions come to light, you'll be imprisoned for life, if not executed. Why do you think Blackburn had to be stopped? There was no choice.
Don't say his name, and don't you dare call me a traitor,
Kane protested.
My God, I'm not used to this. Those sons of bitches you consort with, those thugs, it's their problem.
He slammed down the receiver and patted a sheen of fresh sweat from his brow.
I'm telling you, if those people in the press office don't start doing their jobs, I'm going to have to give every one of them the boot myself,
said President Richard Ballard.
Quite frankly, sir, I don't think they're to blame,
said Stu Incardi, whose official job title was special aide to the president.
You know how it is with reporters. They cover what they want to cover.
Ballard pulled a disgusted face.
Oh, come on. Now, we're about to enter into a genuinely world-changing treaty with Japan and other Far Eastern countries. We've got 3 regional leaders, and yours truly, participating in a signing ceremony aboard a first-of-its-class nuclear sub, and you're trying to say the crypto issue is sexier? Spare me. 2 days from now, I'll be signing the crypto legislation while Roger Gordian makes a fuss down the hill. 2 months from now, everyone will have forgotten all about it and think Morrison Fiore is the name of some Vegas animal training act. But in the interim, I'll have closed a deal that establishes the guidelines for America's security role in Asia over the next 20 years, and probably much longer. There's my posterity, or a decent chunk of it. We just have to make sure people notice.
Sir, I'm thinking we need to make sure Nordstrom from the New York Times is given the red carpet treatment, Incardi said.
Nordstrom's the biggest proponent of our Asia-Pacific policy in the national media. Why not assist him in gaining interviews with the Japanese Prime Minister, as well as the Malaysian and Indonesian heads of state? Invite him to the dinner you'll be having aboard the Seabolt. Anything to give him a steady stream of material to write about.
That sounds fine to me, but only for starters, the president said, his brow creasing in thought.
You know, now that you mention him, it's kind of odd Roger Gordian hasn't convinced Nordstrom to write more about the encryption issue in his columns. He's a paid consultant for Uplink International, did you know?
And Cardi considered that a moment and shrugged.
Could be he disagrees with Gordian on that one.
Then the president added, or just finds the crypto stuff as dull and relatively inconsequential as anybody else. Anna was sitting on the living room sofa, her legs tucked under her, when Kirsten came in from the guest room after having gotten off the phone.
I've just spoken with the police in Singapore. I gave them my name, told them about the men that went after me and Max, told them where I'm staying. They already seemed aware of what happened outside the hotel.
Anna gave her a look that said she'd expected as much.
In a country where chewing gum's contraband and spitting on the streets is a crime, a scuffle of that sort wouldn't go unnoticed. What do they want you to do? They tried persuading me to return to the island and meet with an investigator, but I said I wouldn't. When they realized I wouldn't budge, they said I'd have to arrange something with the police in Johor and would get back to me.
Anna nodded sympathetically.
How do you feel? I feel as if the sky is upside down and the world is in the wrong place. The wrong place, you understand? I'm trying, Kirst. Please believe I'm trying my very best.
At 9 o'clock in the morning, Roger Gordian was scheduled to depart for Washington. He was joined by Chuck Kirby and Vince Scull in the glass-enclosed veranda of his Palo Alto home. The three of them were seated at a large cane table and talking seriously over their breakfast, drinks, papers, and open briefcases. Gordian had just finished summarizing his plan and could already see the unhappiness on Chuck's face. He waited until the attorney wasn't looking and checked his watch, thinking he had a good half hour before his third visitor showed. Time enough to deal with Kirby's inevitable objections. Not that it would be easy. He took a sip of his coffee and listened to Kirby begin arguing that he was about to commit the worst blunder of his life.
Gord, I've heard every word you've spoken and tried my damnedest to keep an open mind, but to do what you proposed before considering a less extreme strategy...
Sometimes you have to lose a limb to preserve the health of the body, Gordian said.
Sometimes survival itself depends on it.
Kirby shook his head.
You're talking about wholesale dismemberment.
Chuck, I haven't said this would be painless. But mentally and emotionally, I've already let go.
Let go of everything you've built up over a decade? Everything you've worked your ass off for?
If you stop for a second, you'll realize you're overreacting, Gordian said. As you pointed out yourself, Chuck, we've grown tremendously since the early 90s. When we secured the contract to provide our GAPS-free missile targeting system to the military, I knew the company's future was assured. I was successful and financially secure. My individual needs were taken care of, and that opened up a whole range of choices about how to put my money and energy into things that mattered to me. My mistake was trying to do it in too many different ways.
Heaven help us, you're sounding like Reynold Armitage, Kirby said, and that gives me the chills.
Gordian smiled wanly.
We'd be foolish to discount his assessment of our strengths and weaknesses merely because the language in which he's couched it troubles us. It's always possible to learn from our enemies, and Armitage's essential point is valid. We need to look at the areas where we're bleeding away resources and liquidate them.
Kirby searched for a response, but Gordian continued speaking before he could think of one.
Chuck, I'd be confident of our expertise in the defense business even if I didn't have the earnings to back me up. We're the best because I've been guided by my past experience as a combat pilot and can remember the sort of technological improvements I'd have wanted when I was in the cockpit flying airstrikes over Khe Sanh. I also know our communications unit represents Uplink's future, irrespective of early stage profits or losses on our investment, and that its potential has yet to be unlocked. Those two are our core operations, the ones that are integral to what I want to accomplish. But ask yourself, do we really belong in computers? Medical tech? Or how about specialty automotive? We only got into that because I wanted to make improvements to the factory standard dune hoppers we were using in our more rugged gateway locations. Which you did. And now that we've assembled a large fleet of vehicles and our competition has incorporated our modifications into their own product, and in some cases outclassed us, if you want my frank opinion, why not release the company to management who can give it proper guidance? After all, its profitability as an uplink company has been marginal from the very beginning. Kirby rubbed the back of his neck.
Gord, listen to me. Uplink's market decline has less to do with over-diversification than with investor fears that your stance on crypto will put you way behind rivals who are eager to sell overseas. And since you're obviously not going to sell off your cryptography firm...
Who says? Gordian interrupted. Kirby looked at him a moment, then turned briefly toward Vince Skull.
Both of you are shitting me here, right?
Skull shook his head. Taken aback, Kirby waited a minute before saying anything more.
Gord, I don't understand. You fought so hard to maintain control of your cryptographic technology. To turn it over to someone else? To chance that it will be distributed abroad? You've never quit a fight before. I can't believe you'd do it under any circumstances.
Not just any, Gordian said. Chuck, I... Gordian broke off, his eyes going to the sliding doors which opened from the house to the veranda. Andrew, his domestic, had appeared with Richard Sobel, the third guest he'd been expecting for breakfast.
Morning!
Sobel tipped the other men a wave. Gordian motioned him to an empty chair at the table.
You're right on schedule, Rich. Join the party.
Kirby gave Gordian a level glance, saw his spreading grin, and suddenly understood everything.
You can relax now, Chuck, Gordian said, his smile growing even larger. Our white knight has arrived to save the day. On a stubby finger of rock jutting off his island base's ocean side, General Kursik stared out across the benighted water at the lights of Sandakan Harbor. Restless, he had left the training camp and all his soldiers who were busily preparing for attack. He thought the freshness of the breeze would somehow dispel his somber mood, but instead it had made him feel worse. He supposed it was his knowledge of the violence that soon would be launched from his pristine shoreline, the deaths that were inevitably to come. There would be dozens, perhaps hundreds, if not many, many more. For a just cause, yes, or anyway a cause in which he squarely believed. But wasn't that the same ancient, self-righteous madness which drove every act of war? Kursik's brow creased above his bushy eyebrows. He had renounced his allegiance to his country's government and was about to place himself in defiance of the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, Japan, and the United States. The entire world, really. Before all was said and done, he would be called a rogue, an international pariah. What would he think of himself in the end? Might a division ultimately form in his own mind, half of him feeling validated, half condemned? Kursik gazed out at the lights of a city that in the last 150 years had been governed once by the Germans, twice by the British, and exploited by traders, gunrunners, and timberlords from diverse corners of the globe. That during World War II was invaded by the Japanese and leveled by American bombs, and that now, literally and ironically, held the keys to the fate of both those nations. Kursik stood and thought and looked out across the ocean swells. After a while, he stepped into the brush and walked back toward camp.
So, Alex, Stu and Cardi said, what I'm saying is that it looks like I can get you to dine with the President of the United States and the other heads of state in the officer's wardroom.
Is that what you're saying?
Nordstrom said.
That is exactly what I'm saying. Right there in the belly of the beast we call Seabolt.
They were talking over a lunch of quesadillas, cactus salad, and chili at the Red Sage on Northwest 14th, roughly midway between the Kennedy Center and the White House.
And who's setting this up?
Terskov, the press secretary himself, and Cardi emphasized.
Nordstrom ate some of his quesadilla.
What's the catch?
And Cardi combed back a wave of his lush black hair with his fingers.
Oh, you mean President Ballard's request? All the president would like is that you absent yourself from Roger Gordian's press conference tomorrow. That is, assuming you've considered attending.
Nordstrom carefully set his knife and fork down in his plate and straightened.
I will stand beside Roger Gordian tomorrow, come hell, high water, or sugar-coated coercion from the highest levels of government.
Alex, you could be interviewing Prime Minister Yamamoto over caviar and champagne instead of chowing down in the goat locker with the enlisted personnel. Don't pass up the opportunity of a lifetime.
Nordstrom crossed his arms.
You're annoying me.
Alex,
don't whine. It makes you look like a schoolboy.
And Cardi frowned, wiped his mouth furiously with his napkin, and tossed it down on the table.
There was nothing more to be said.
The transcontinental haul from San Francisco to Johor Bahru had been a grueling and seemingly endless affair for Nimick and Noriko Cousins, with a late-night changeover from their 747 to a prop-driven rattletrap in Kuala Lumpur, and, following their jump to JB, a treacherous 40-minute drive over dark, winding, poorly mapped roads in the rental car Nimick had reserved at the airport. Though Nimick had been at the Johor ground station on only one prior occasion, and though it had occurred to him before departing the States that it might be wise to have somebody from the local sword contingent come out to the airfield and meet them, he had finally decided to drive to their end destination himself. At any rate, it was just shy of 5 in the morning when Nimick found Uplink's corporate emblem on a sign marking a dirt service road and, looking off beyond the tree line to his right, glimpsed the concrete and aluminum buildings of the ground station in the near distance. Nimick drove on through the gate toward the complex, nodding to the uniformed man in the guard booth as he passed him.
"Tired from our journey to the east?"
he asked Nori.
"And wired. Not a good mix if you plan to get any sleep."
He lifted a folded newspaper from the passenger seat and held it out to her over his shoulder.
"Here, take this copy of the Straits Times I grabbed at the KL airport. Maybe it'll help you relax."
Nori took the paper from his hand, set it down beside her, and yawned again.
"Thanks. I'll be sure to fill you in on the local news over breakfast."
In the corridor outside the East Room of the White House, a room throbbing with reporters, prominent members of Congress, and other official guests invited to the Morrison Fiore bill signing ceremony, the president was anxious to put pen to paper. Now that he'd been induced to make a huge ceremonial affair of the signing, C-SPAN cameras dollying about, Kleegs in his face, the whole nine yards, he wanted it over and done with so that public attention could be turned to something of real significance to him, namely CPAC, a child he had guided from infancy, watching it take on polish, refinement, and sophistication under his savvy political eye, that he viewed as the most important policy effort of his tenure in the White House, that he believed was the blueprint for a new strategic and logistic collaboration in the Pacific Rim, that he was certain would reinforce America's ties with its Asian partners and decide the future of its own security interests in the region. What was Morrison Fiore in comparison besides a piece of moot legislation, easing commercial restrictions that had already been bypassed with countless loopholes? Meanwhile, the Murrah room at the NPC building was packed with newsies. Like some huge self-replicating organism, the Washington Press Corps had divided between two fronts of a battle that hoped was about to reach a roaring public climax, with the president and Roger Gordian hurling verbal thunderbolts across Pennsylvania Avenue. Mounting the podium, Gordian waited for a long moment. Chuck Kirby, Megan Breen, Vince Scull, and Alex Nordstrom behind him on the right, Dan Parker, Richard Sobel, and FBI Director Robert Lang on his left.
"Ladies and gentlemen of the press,
thank you for coming today," Gordian finally said.
"Right now, only a few short blocks away from here, the Morrison Fiore cryptographic deregulation bill is being signed into law. I don't know what personal view you may have about it, but for the past several months I have tried to make mine clear."
Gordian paused, adjusted his microphone.
"I know a little about technology and its importance as a binding and unifying global force. I believe that knowledge is freedom, and information the core and cornerstone of knowledge. But the reality is that America has its enemies. We would be mistaken to confuse the globalization of advanced technology with the abdication of our rights and imperatives as a sovereign nation. And I believe Morrison Fiore is a disturbing step along that road.
My critics, on the other hand, argue that I am vainly trying to put the genie back in the bottle by advocating we control encryption technology as we might any other powerful tool. They argue that because cryptographic software may be smuggled across the transparent borders of cyberspace with relative ease, we ought to pretend those borders do not exist, rather than better define and regulate them. This sort of thinking baffles me. Are we to cease attempting to check electronic piracy only because it may be difficult to do so? International criminals and practitioners of violence already know encryption technology can afford them a formidable advantage over law enforcement, a new and sophisticated layer of secrecy by which their activities can be concealed. I assure you, when we concede an advantage to crime and criminals, we do worse than allow the disintegration of legal boundaries. We risk the disintegration of our will as a civilization. And that, ladies and gentlemen, frightens me more than anything as an individual. As he reached the end of his speech, Gordian pushed aside his written notes, sipped from the glass of water on the lectern. Not too shoddy, he thought. At this point, I'd be glad to take some questions. A clattering commotion as three quarters of the room sprang off their chairs. Gordian pointed to the guy in the first row at the famous website.
Mr. Gordian, we were informed you would be making a significant announcement on the corporate front, and though you did not address this issue in your speech to us, I'm wondering if there's anything you can reveal about your future as chairman of Uplink International.
Gordian looked at him with genuine surprise. Damned if he hadn't nearly forgotten in all the excitement.
Oh, yes. Now that you remind me, there certainly is.
The East Room erupted into noisy, enthusiastic applause the instant the president hastily and perfunctorily put his signature on the last page of Morrison Fiore. No longer a bill now, but law of the land. Congratulations flew. The Senate whips clasped hands. The Speaker of the House and his rival from the minority party embraced in bipartisan triumph. The Veep posed for photographs, basking in his commander-in-chief's reflected light, hoping it would enhance his own glimmer when his turn to seek his party's nod for the presidency came about in 2 years or so. Disgusted, President Ballard wanted to get to sleep. He had a long flight to Japan ahead of him in the morning, and then a historic ride on a submarine that it looked like nobody on the planet was going to notice. Roger Gordian held the room spellbound as he concluded his remarks on the future of Uplink. And Mr. Sobel will acquire the firms comprising Uplink's entire computer products division, including Stronghold Security Systems, our cryptographic hardware and software subsidiary. As someone who has known and worked with Rich for over a decade, I have confidence my corporate children will attain impressive and unprecedented levels of success. Gordian pointed to one of the upraised hands in front of him. The young lady from the Wall Street Journal, he said. Ms. Sheffield, is it? She nodded and stood.
Sir, with all due respect, how will that growth be possible as long as Mr. Sobel preserves your restrictions on crypto export? Many industry analysts disagree with your contention that a cryptographic firm can focus primarily on the domestic market and remain profitable. Or will those policies be relaxed after the sale?
Sobel suddenly stepped up to share the podium.
With our host's permission, I'm going to answer that myself. I can unequivocally state that I support Roger Gordian on the encryption issue and will carry on his present policies to the letter. Success is all in how you approach the marketplace, and my electronics firm is existing proof that the analysts you mention are wrong. Our net profits have increased every year for the past 5 years. We have grown slowly by intention and built a solid reputation designing latchkey systems for corporate clients, using many of Roger Gordian's cryptographic products. As a service and support-oriented company, we believe Roger Gordian's superior data encoding systems will both attract new clients and present limitless advantages to our existing ones.
The question fired at him courtesy of someone from Business Week was the charm.
Mr. Gordian, how will your plans be affected should the Spartus Consortium finalize the sale of their stake in Uplink,
which amounts to fully one-fifth of the company, an enormous minority holding, to Marcus Kane, who we all know hasn't been over to your home for dinner lately.
It was a setup so Bell couldn't resist.
As part of our overall deal, Uplink will be placing an equal portion of its stock in my hands. If Marcus Kane wants to make himself an uninvited guest at the table, he'll have to sit across from Roger Gordian and myself from now on, look us both squarely in the eye, and learn it isn't an all-you-can-eat. And let me tell you, people, if Kane tries grabbing anything from my plate, he damn well better watch out for my fork.
A beat of surprised silence from the audience, and then laughter over Sobel's quip. A great rising swell of laughter. Gordian looked out at the room and was embarrassed by the realization that he was grinning himself, but not too embarrassed. Boom, he thought. Bombshell delivered. And dead on in the crosshairs, no less. In his office, watching C-SPAN, Kane lowered the croissant he'd been eating to his desk. He felt his stomach burning savagely. It was as if he were on fire inside. Those bastards, he thought incredulously. Those bastards! He had to credit Gordian's resourcefulness. By segmenting off entire divisions of Uplink, he would almost certainly gain the capital to dispose of his outstanding debts. By parting with a cryptographic operation, he had eliminated the greatest cause of his shareholders' dissatisfaction, and no doubt raised the price of Uplink's stock to its highest level in years. And by handing Sobel a chunk of the core outfit, making him White Knight and Squire all in one, he had forged an alliance that would decisively give him control of the company, just when it had been within Kane's grasp. In order to overthrow that alliance, or even mitigate its control, Kane, or any buyer of voting stock, would now need to acquire an improbable and newly expensive number of shares. A terrible, nauseous, crashing sensation added itself to the pain tearing at Kane's gut, and he was suddenly afraid he might be sick. Even knowing what he'd set in motion at Gordian's data storage facility tonight didn't help. Nya and his confederates would get what they wanted, but he... His hand shaking, he lifted the plate of croissants off his desk, slipped it into the wastebasket, and stared at the television screen in an agony of his own hatred. No, he would not, could not concede that he was beaten. Pete Nimick clicked off the answering machine and looked at Nori in silence. They'd just listened to a series of Kirsten Chu's increasingly anxious messages to Max Blackburn. Messages that had gone unanswered. Though it was not yet dawn in Johor, and both were running on empty, they were in Blackburn's spare single-room living quarters at the ground station, having decided to check it out for clues to his whereabouts before heading off to bed. There had been nothing to help them on that score, but Kirsten Chu's messages, the most recent of which had been left 2 days earlier according to the machine's time-date stamp, at least revealed that she had not completely vanished from the face of the earth as well.
Sounds like she's staying with her sister, Nori said after a while.
Hiding out's more like it. You catch the sister's name, or do I have to run through the tape again?
Anna. No second name, though. And Kirsten mentioned there being a husband, so it'd be a different surname from her own. Makes it harder to track her down.
True enough, but we do know Kirsten lives in Singapore. If we're lucky, she'll be listed in the public telephone directory. If she's in the book, we'll likely find out where she lives.
And the next step would be to get in there and look around for something with Sis's address written on it, Nori said, completing his thought.
Nimick nodded agreement.
I hate to risk breaking and entering, but if we have no better alternative...
Nori wobbled her hand in the air to interrupt him.
Leave that part to me.
It was a little past 4 in the afternoon when the two men in the Olds Cutlass drove up to the entry gate of the Uplink Cryptographics facility in Sacramento, slowing to a halt as they reached the guard station.
Detective Steve Lombardi, the driver told the guard through his open window. My partner here is Detective Craig Sanford.
The guard regarded them through his mirrored sunglasses.
How can I help you? We need to speak to the supervisor in charge, Lombardi said.
We got a subpoena for crypto keys. You know the deal.
The guard nodded. It was standard operating procedure for law enforcement to deliver court orders whenever there was an investigation or legal action involving the release of data recovery keys used by Uplink software. With everybody from banks to supermarkets to mafia hoods using crypto in their daily business operations nowadays, and thousands of keys stored in the data recovery vaults, and all kinds of civil and criminal cases in which computerized files were requested as evidence, it wasn't unusual to get as many as 4 or 5 visits a week from police officers delivering subpoenas.
"Just need to see your ID and papers,"
the guard said. The driver took the requested items out of his sport jacket and gave them to the guard. The guard studied the ID and paperwork, then nodded and returned them through the window of his booth.
"Go right on ahead, fellas."
The driveway leading up to the encryption facility terminated in a parking lot outside the main entrance, the left side of which was reserved for staff, the right for visitors. The men in the Cutlass swung into the visitors' section, found an empty slot, strode across the parking lot toward the flat cinderblock building, and approached the armed guard posted at the door.
"Detectives Lombardi and Neil," he said, smiling pleasantly.
They both nodded.
"I was informed you gentlemen were on your way from the gate,"
the guard said, and gestured toward the walk-through weapons detector beside his station.
"If you'd please leave your service weapons with me and place any other metal articles you may have in the tray to your right, you can step through the scanners and come in."
The two men unholstered their firearms, both were carrying standard Glock 9s, and turned them over to the guard, then deposited their coins and keychains in the tray and passed through the archway. When he'd passed through, Lombardi stuffed his keychain into his pocket.
"Just hope we don't have to chase any armed robbers while we're here," he said, smiling a little at the guard.
The guard laughed.
"Have no fear. This place is as safe as they come."
Noriko Cousins was as slick as they came. She'd gone to Kirsten Chu's building and, with a little wheedling and a lot of crocodile tears, convinced the super to admit her to Kirsten's apartment. Now Nori slipped into the rear of the white company Land Rover parked 3 blocks from Kirsten Chu's residence.
"Found what we wanted," she said. "I've got a personal phone book with a number and address for a Lin and Anna Lung in Petaling Jaya."
"Where the hell's that?"
"Back over the causeway, La, outside KL."
This from the driver, a Malay named Osmar Ali, who was with the sword detail at the ground station. Nimick nodded.
"You sure the right party, Nori?"
"Pretty much," she said.
"I also dug up an open mailing envelope with a return address that matches the one in the book. There were some photos of a couple and 2 kids inside it, and a letter that starts with a dear sis."
Nimick turned to look at Osmar.
"Petaling Jaya. Is it within driving distance?"
Osmar shrugged.
"Can go, yes, but at a few 100 kilometers. Be faster, we drive back to ground station, take helicopter."
Nimick thought in silence a moment, then he reached for the cell phone resting in the molded plastic cup holder beside him.
"Better let me have that number, Nori. I want to see if anybody's home before we come knocking on their door."
The pair of men strode through the corridor after leaving their guns at the checkpoint. Midway down another corridor branching to their left was an office door marked Security. The one who called himself Lombardi gave the other an almost imperceptible glance, and they went over to it. 2 plainclothes security men were sitting at a bank of closed-circuit monitors when the office door opened inward from the corridor.
"Can we help you, gentlemen?"
one of them said, swiveling to face the door. The man called Lombardi entered, followed by his partner. They let the door close behind them.
"We're looking for the supervisor's office."
He smiled, his hand casually tucked in his pants pocket.
"Thought it was supposed to be right around here somewhere."
"Took a wrong turn,"
the security man said.
"When you leave this office, hang a right and..."
Lombardi's hand came out of his pocket holding his key ring. Before the security guards could register what was happening, he brought up its rectangular fob and quickly tugged back the attached chain with his free hand. This cocked the firing mechanism of the weapon, which was only 3 inches long and contained 2 .32-caliber bullets. He pointed it at the man facing him and pushed a button on its side. The slug that coughed from the tiny gun's bore struck the guard in the middle of the forehead and killed him instantly, slamming him back into the panel of monitors. The shooter pivoted toward the other guard. His face white with shock, he was reaching for the holstered weapon under his jacket. The shooter pushed the button and fired his second shot, striking the guard in the center of his face. And then his face was gone. The body sprawled backward, blood, bone fragments, and tissue spraying the screens and walls behind him. The shooter looked at his partner, gesturing toward the dead men. Close. I only expected there to be one of them. The man near the door nodded.
Let's take their guns and get on with it.
When Kirsten Chu heard Anna's phone ring at 9:30, she picked up. Kirsten Chu, please. She hesitated, her heart suddenly banging in her chest. Who's calling? My name is Pete Nimick, and I'm... She didn't even hear him finish the sentence. So completely overwhelming was the recognition that swept over her.
Dear God, that's the name. You're Max's friend, aren't you? The one he wanted me to call?
Yes, I am.
How is he?
She interrupted. Worry had swept chillingly through Kirsten's initial excitement. If Max were all right, why wouldn't he be calling?
Kirsten, we need to meet. I have to speak with you in person, find out what's happened to him. To both of you.
You mean you don't know?
No, Kirsten, I don't. No one's heard from him. She clutched the phone, her hand shaking around it, her entire arm shaking.
All right. I'll give you my address.
The men had left Penang State, southeast of the Malaysia-Thailand border, shortly after they'd received the call from Khao Luan. That had been some hours ago at dawn, and they'd been driving their van down the main coastal highways to Selangor ever since. The trip would have been lengthy under the best of traffic conditions, but there were herds of beach-going tourists jamming the roads near the bridge and ferry terminals to Georgetown, and the delays had stretched miserably in the hot, beating sun. The men in the van had furthermore wanted to keep a moderate speed so as not to risk being pulled over by police. The crisp tattoos on their hands would bring about an instant search, and once that happened, their problems would only be starting. If the police found their weapons, they could look forward to many hours of painful interrogation, followed by many years of being locked away in prison halls. And that would be a far cry from the reward they were expecting for the successful completion of their task. The Thai had promised them a fortune in greenbacks for capturing a woman and delivering her to him in Kalimantan. They had joked crudely about her physical attributes when they received the call, and in spite of their grindingly slow progress, it would not be long before they saw the object of Luan's desire for themselves. They were already better than halfway down through Perak and would be crossing into Selangor within a couple of hours. With luck, Kirsten Chu would be at the address they had been given. And if not, they would gladly wait there for her to arrive.
Is there some kind of problem, Mr. Vernon?
The man calling himself Lombardi asked the facility supervisor from where he sat in the waiting area outside the data storage wing. Holding the court papers, a puzzled expression on his face, Vernon glanced at him as he returned through a doorway he'd entered just moments ago.
The name of the corporation simply doesn't show on our database. I don't know what to make of it.
Lombardi rose and sidled up to him, grinning.
Then I guess those papers are fake and the company doesn't exist.
Vernon looked at him.
I don't understand.
Lombardi reached under his jacket and drew the Beretta he'd taken from one of the murdered security guards.
Oh, I think you do,
he said, and rammed the handle of the weapon upward into Vernon's nose, shattering his septum and sending tiny slivers of bone into his brain. Vernon dropped instantly to the floor, his eyes rolling up in their sockets, dark blood spouting from his nostrils. He spasmed twice, emitted a labored, gurgling sound, and died. Lombardi gestured to the other man as he got up off his seat. Then both went around the body and passed through the end of the vault area. A short while before the ringing of the doorbell startled her into alertness, Kirsten had slipped into a doze on the sofa. She glanced at the clock on the wall opposite her. It was 3:15. Could Nimick have arrived already? He'd told her he was in Singapore when he called, and that had been, what, about 7 hours ago. Under average circumstances, it would have been highly unlikely he could have made it in so short a time. She crossed the room to the door, straightening her blouse, smoothing her skirt down with her hands.
Yes? Who is it?
Johor Police. We want to see Kirsten Chu. It's about her call. We need to ask her some questions.
Kirsten raised the spy hole cover, peered outside, and felt her stomach turn to ice. None of the men standing in the walk outside, she could see four or five of them through the little two-way mirror, looked anything like police investigators. Their hair was long, their clothes sloppy, and their eyes. She pulled away from the spy hole and inhaled shakily.
Just a minute. I need to put something on.
One man slammed the door with his forearm.
Forget the games. Open it.
Terrified, her breaths coming in sharp little bursts, Kirsten whirled and plunged through the apartment. An instant later, the door crashed open behind her. Kirsten ran toward the back of the apartment, hearing the men who'd been outside come pounding through the living room at her heels. She had only a vague notion of what to do, but it was all she had, and there was no choice except to go with it. If she could make it to the back door before they caught up, get into the building's central parking court, then maybe...
Hey, stop, you fucking bitch!
Kirsten flung herself at the back door, clutched the knob, and tore it open. Gasping for breath, she dashed out into the automobile court and headed for cover among the cars. In the darkness, Kirsten squatted on her haunches, trembling with fright, trying not to move, afraid the slightest sound would give her position away to her pursuers. She could hear their feet crunching on the asphalt as they moved up and down the aisles of cars. More footsteps. Closer. She hugged herself, trying to think clearly through her fear. Then she heard the crunch of another footfall. She waited another second, took a deep gulp of air, and then forced herself to spring to her feet. A man on her left spotted her instantly. Their eyes made the briefest contact, hers full of hunted terror, his absent of any hint of sympathy or compassion. Then he rasped an order to his companions and came hurtling across the aisle at her. Kirsten turned and fled. The first indication that something was wrong came the moment they pulled their rental car up to the curb, and it was the only one they needed. If there were a way to think things were normal after arriving at a person's home and finding the door kicked in, Nimick didn't know it. "Have your weapons ready," he said to Noriko and Osmar, withdrawing his Beretta 8040 from its concealment holster. "Don't seem to be any eyes around, but if somebody does call the local gendarmes, we'll get it straight with them later." Following his lead, the others jogged out of the car and across the ground-level unit's front yard to the partially open door. Nimick instinctively moved to the right of the doorframe.
"Kirsten, this is Pete Nimick,"
he called through the opening, leaning his head around the splintered jamb.
"Are you okay in there?"
No reply.
"Go,"
he said. They rushed into the apartment and fanned out in a practiced crossover maneuver. Nimick moving to the left of the entrance, gun held ready, Noriko and Osmar following him and button-hooking to the right. The three of them rapidly pivoted to cover the center of the room with their weapons, legs apart, making broad sweeps of their sectors of fire. They seemed to be alone in the place.
"Kirsten, you here?"
Nimick called again. Still no answer. Noriko tapped his arm.
"Look," she said, pointing straight across the living room. The back door was wide open.
Nimick's eyes flicked between her and Osmar.
"Come on,"
he said, and rushed toward the door. When they'd stolen the disks loaded with the encryption keys they'd come for, the two intruders paused in the hall and exchanged glances. Confused, frightened staffers poured from doorways on either side of them. Not a word was spoken. They could see that the greatest commotion was down the left bend of the corridor and knew the bodies of the guards had been discovered. Their original intention had been to walk out the main entrance, and they knew they would have to gamble on still being able to leave that way in the disturbance. It would be dangerous, but any attempt to leave the building through emergency exits would trip sensors which would likely pinpoint the specific door being open, and they had no illusions about having eliminated the threat from security. The men at the surveillance monitors would not have been the sole members of the plainclothes team on premises, and there was the uniformed guard at the door. The intruders could only keep their fingers crossed he'd be sufficiently distracted for them to slip past, otherwise they'd have to kill him, too. They moved forward through the scared, noisy people in the corridor and were nearly at the checkpoint where they'd have to leave their guns when an alarm sounded, a loud on-and-off noise that grated on the eardrums. The guard at the door seemed to be tracking them with his eyes as they approached.
"We're going out to radio for assistance,"
the one who'd called himself Lombardi said. His hand was in his jacket pocket. The guard looked at him.
"I'm sorry, the building's been sealed."
"Don't insult me," Lombardi said. "We have a job to do." He started to move forward, Neil walking beside him. The guard clamped a hand around Lombardi's arm.
"You need to call somebody. We have phones in here, but nobody's leaving."
Lombardi smiled. His hand was still in his jacket.
"Don't bet on it,"
he said, and squeezed the trigger of the pistol he'd taken from the guards in the monitor room. Hit at point-blank range, the security guard catapulted backward off his feet, a cloud of blood exploding from his chest. Lombardi pumped two more bullets into him as he dropped to the ground, finishing him. He turned to his companion and waved him along. He was aware of screams, pale faces, racing feet behind them on the concrete floor. They hastened toward the door and got as far as the archway of the weapons detector when someone behind them shouted out an order to halt. They kept walking.
"I said freeze," the voice repeated. "This is your final warning."
Without turning, they quickened their pace. A gunshot fired out from behind them. Marty whirled and saw a plainclothes guard in the center of the corridor, both hands around a gun, his knees bent in a shooter's stance. He returned fire, missed, heard a thud, thud, thud from the suited guard's gun, and then was slapped across the middle by something he didn't see. He looked down at himself, his eyes wide with shock, and had just enough time to glimpse the bloody amalgam of flesh and shredded clothing that had replaced his stomach before he crumpled in a dying heap. The other intruder reached for his own gun, but before he'd gotten it out of his pocket, saw two more plainclothesmen emerge from the branching corridors at his rear. They all had their weapons drawn and had triangulated their aim to put him in a perfect crossfire.
"Hold it!"
He dropped the gun to the floor and slowly raised his hands above his head.
"Don't shoot, okay? Okay?"
Their guns extended. The sword ops moved in and took him. Swinging around the grill of a car, Kirsten ran like hell, making for the driveway in a wild, headlong dash. She heard overlapping footsteps behind her, close, close, and pushed herself to move even faster, her legs pumping, arms working at her sides like pistons. And then, suddenly, one of her pursuers sprang from behind a parked car several yards in front of her. He had some kind of gun in his hand, a submachine gun, she thought, though she was hardly an expert, and was holding it out at her.
"No more shit from you!"
he said in Bahasa. She halted, glanced over her shoulders. Two more of the men who'd come for her were walking quickly in her direction, their firearms held downward, flat against their legs. The fourth stalker had emerged near the spot where she'd been hiding.
"Just come on over here and I won't hurt you,"
said the one blocking her path to the driveway. He motioned with his gun.
"Let's go."
Kirsten didn't budge and was amazed to realize she was shaking her head in the negative. He shrugged, holding his weapon steady. She could hear the other three coming close behind her.
"Hold it right there!"
The voice echoing through the court stopped all four of the men in their tracks. An expression of stunned surprise on his features, the one in front of Kirsten abruptly looked around for its source.
"Drop the gun!"
the voice said in Bahasa. Still looking from side to side, the man blocking the driveway moved the gun off of Kirsten, but didn't lower it. Kirsten heard a crack like the sound of a detonating firecracker, and then a blossom of crimson appeared in the middle of the man's ribcage, and he pitched face down to the asphalt, his submachine gun clattering from his grasp.
"I hope the rest of you are smarter," the voice said. "It's finished."
Kirsten turned her head, saw one of the gunmen behind her start to raise his weapon, instantly heard two more sharp cracks, only now coming from a different part of the court. The man screamed and fell over, clutching his knees, blood spraying out from between his fingers. The remaining pair of men tossed down their weapons and started to run, scrambling out of the aisle and then bolting wildly toward the driveway exit. No one tried to stop them. Her eyes wide and staring, Kirsten looked uncomprehendingly around the court, and all at once saw a brown-skinned Malaysian man spring to his feet behind the tail of a car directly across from where the first stalker had fallen dead. An instant later, two more people appeared near the one who'd been shot in the knees. a white man with close-cropped hair and an Oriental woman. The man with the short hair holstered his gun beneath his jacket and approached her.
"Kirsten, it's okay. You're safe. I'm Pete Nimick."
She started to say something in response, but her throat had closed up, and her teeth were chattering too violently. Instead, she strode over to him, put her face against his shoulder, put her arms around him, and started crying. Noriko had gone to wait in the apartment with Kirsten while Nimick and Osmar took care of business in the parking lot.
"Mr. Nimick, there's something I must show you."
"Right." Nimick finished flex-cuffing the wounded man, folded a blanket he'd gotten from the apartment under his head, then went over to Osmar. Kneeling over the body of the one he'd dropped, the Malay lifted his motionless hand off the asphalt.
"You see Chris' tattoo?"
Nimick nodded. "Guy I cuffed has exactly the same marking on him. What the hell is it, some kind of cult sign?" Osmar shook his head.
"It's more like what you Americans call..."
He made a low sound of concentration in his throat, as if groping hard for words. Then he snapped his fingers.
"Ah, colors."
"Gang colors, you mean," Nimick said.
"As in the Crips and Bloods."
Osmar nodded and placed his finger on the tattooed skin.
"The Chris. Many pirate gangs have such marks. But you see designs on blade?"
Nimick squatted beside him for a closer look. He did indeed see them. Grotesque anthropomorphic figures which reminded him of the little paintings on Egyptian tombs.
"They are Akasa,"
Osmar said.
"Demons. Different for each brotherhood."
Sudden understanding spread across Nimick's features. "These two punks. Someone familiar with regional gang crime would be able to tell their affiliation from the markings." Osmar nodded again.
"And this one I know well from when I was with police. The men work for Cao Luan. He is Kuomintang."
The word rang a vague bell. Nimick searched his memory a few seconds.
"A heroin trader?"
Another nod.
"None are more powerful. The Thai army, they make him to flee during pacification program. 10 years ago, maybe more. Since then, he is in Indonesia."
Nimick gave him an imperative look.
"Where? Does anybody know where?" "Everyone knows, and everyone fears to touch him," Osmar said. "In parts of Banjarmasin, the Thai has longer arms than the government."
Nimick was quiet, letting it all sink in. What connection could a man like that have to Monolith? What on earth had Max stumbled onto? After a moment, he clapped a hand on Osmar's arm and nodded firmly.
"My friend, we're about to do some more island hopping," he said. "And I promise you, if this guy's involved in Blackburn's disappearance, I'll cut his fucking arms off myself."
The surviving member of the pair that got into the Sacramento vault hadn't talked. Not to the sword detail that apprehended him, not to the feds after he'd been given into their custody, and it was anybody's guess whether he was going to talk. Gordian, however, wasn't sure that was essential to determining who had been behind the act. The main question for him, then, was of motive. Back in San Jose from D.C., Gordian sat at his desk opposite Chuck Kirby, trying to put the pieces of a complex and profoundly troubling puzzle into place.
"Let's start with the disc they took," Kirby said.
"The disc."
Gordian sighed. "The key codes are used in communication systems Uplink is designed for a wide range of naval vessels. Obviously, they would be of enormous value to any number of interests, both foreign and domestic."
"Allies and enemies, for that matter," Kirby said. "Everybody spies on everybody else. It's wide open until you look at how the thieves penetrated the vault."
Gordian's face tightened.
"It's Marcus Kane behind all this, damn it. I can't prove it, but I know it's him. Think about it. Max is investigating Kane's business operations in Asia. Max drops out of sight. I take on the Morrison Fiore bill. Kane jumps into the ring as a challenger, then as a person who wants to devour my corporation. Somebody breaks into my encryption facility, and so on and so forth. There's too much coincidence. And now the whole thing seems to have taken on a sense of acceleration, almost desperation."
Or urgency, Kirby said. If we're going to walk down the road you're inclined to lead us down, the keys on that disc they tried to snatch are at the heart of this.
Gordian nodded, his hands steepled under his chin. The two men sat there quietly a while, thinking everything through. 5 minutes passed, then several more. More thought, more silence. Suddenly, Gordian sat forward, his eyes widening. Chuck looked at him.
Something the matter?
That word you used, Gordian said. Urgency. It's just that... Oh, my God, how could I not have seen? That's why it's come to a head now. My God, the ceremony, the maiden run is today.
Gord, what the hell's wrong?
Gordian shot his hand across the desk and gripped Kirby's wrist. The sea bolt, he said. It's command and control systems, the systems that run the sub. They use uplink encryption software. And the spare keys. The keys are on that disk. Kirby was staring at him incredulously.
Gord, I'm not sure I'm reading you or want to be reading you, but even if I am, the thing to remember is nobody got hold of them.
Gordian sliced his right hand through the air to silence him, still digging the fingers of his left into Kirby's wrist.
They aren't the only keys, Chuck, he said abruptly,
his face white as a sheet.
You understand? We're talking about a nuclear submarine, a boat the president's going to be aboard. And they aren't the only keys.
The Chinese hovercraft had arrived at the atoll under cover of darkness, transported in the well decks of two civilian tankers that had been refitted for military usage. Nearly 90 feet long and half as wide, each amphibious landing craft was powered by four 16,000-horsepower turbines, two of which fed the shrouded air screws which would thrust it along at better than 50 knots, the others driving the centrifugal fans which provided vertical lift, allowing the craft to float above sea and stand on a smooth cushion of air. Their decks bristled with pintle-mounted 12.7mm Type 77 machine guns and 40mm grenade launchers. Standing on the beach of the lagoon, General Kursik watched his men board their vessels in preparation for the Sandakan raid, most of them filing up the ramps onto the four lozenge-shaped flotation craft assembled at the tide line, the rest climbing into a swarm of slender aluminum-hulled cigarette boats. Zhu Shang had delivered as promised, and for that, as for many other qualities, Kursik deeply respected him. Perhaps one day they would meet again in some civilized place, a place where they could comfortably reminisce about all they had seen and done since they'd first met as younger men. One an Indonesian general full of pride and aspiration, one a spirited communist builder seeking to give shape to utopia, both holding dreams of Asian unity and greatness. Yes, Kursik thought, perhaps they would indeed meet at some future time and discuss how their greatest dreams had been attained at stages of their lives when most men were snugly wrapped in soft blankets of contentment. And together they would recollect the monumental day the Japanese and Americans, who sought to dominate the region, were swallowed by an underwater behemoth of their own creation. For now, though, there was only the certain prospect of the attack about to be launched. Adjusting the pack on his shoulders, Kursik strode across the sand and boarded the vessel that would carry him to battle. Cao Luan strode along the boardwalk toward his dwelling on the canal, popping fried, sugared pieces of tempeh goreng into his mouth. Stress always made him hungry, and he had awakened famished today. With good reason, too. This business he'd gotten into, Sandakan, the hijack of a nuclear submarine, the hostage-taking of the President of the United States. Ah, though, how it had evolved. He walked on, tossing another bit of food into his mouth. Finally, he reached the ladder that climbed to his door and gripped the ladder frame to hoist himself upward. Close by, a young female vendor in a loose-fitting sarong hunched forward in her canoe, her head lowering behind mounds of fruit, her hands slipping under a natty hank of cloth. When that hand reappeared a moment later, it was holding a flat, palm-sized radio.
"Empire State to South Philly, do you read?"
the vendor said, transmitting over a trunked digital channel.
"Loud and clear, Empire State. The rooster back in the barn?"
Just strutted in. Big and nasty in life as in pictures.
A brief pause. She bent lower, waiting, holding the radio out of sight.
Sit tight, Empire State, the voice replied after a second. We're on our way to pluck his feathers.
Jointly sponsored by the Republics of the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, from its original blueprints to its funding and final construction, the Sandokan Cryptographic Key Storage Bank was the largest in Asia and the second largest in the world, ranking only behind a subsequently built facility of its type in Europe. In terms of proportion, it was to most of the world's other key recovery banks what Citibank was to a small-town SNL. Sprawling across many acres of shoreline, the concrete and steel structure gave a fortress-like impression and was protected by a sophisticated array of alarm systems and guard units of chiefly Malaysian and Indonesian composition. All this security was in place for a simple reason. The spare key codes stored within its vaults were those of the region's largest governmental, military, and financial institutions. It had been regarded as a logical, convenient, and secure place for the Japanese and American governments to store the spare keys to many of Seabolt's encrypted operational systems, including those which controlled its Advanced Seal Delivery System, or ASDS, docking hatches. These would allow a fully pressurized mini-sub containing from 8 to 12 special op divers to launch and recover its personnel during insertions requiring long-distance deep submergence transport. As planned, when the SEALs returned from a mission aboard the 65-foot ASDS vehicle, the computers aboard their vessel would signal the Seabolt's control systems to open the ASDS hatch so that the crew and passengers, and their equipment, could re-enter the submarine via its docking chamber and move from there onto its main decks. Nya sat in his den now, watching the CPAC ribbon-cutting ceremony on television. Today he would put aside his worries and enjoy himself. Could the Seabolt be tricked into swallowing a poison pill? After all, it was in theory only a matter of putting the right keys into the wrong hands. Wrong from the American and Japanese standpoint, that was. And while Marcus Kane's failure to deliver the command and control keys had been a setback, it had, in a sense, only added to the excitement. Once Kursik got his hands on the Sandokan keys, the divers would still be able to open the ASDS hatch. After that, they would simply have to put greater reliance on force than finesse, and use guns and bullets rather than keystrokes and passwords to take the submarine. And maybe, if he were very fortunate, there would even be a little bloodshed to make things more interesting. Leaning out the door of the Belljet Ranger chopper, Nimick extracted a tubular magazine from his utility webbing, slapped it into his 12-gauge with the heel of his hand, and pumped the forestock to chamber the shell. Like Osmar and the three other sword ops in his team, he had on a pullover cowl, gas mask, and black Nomex stealth suit. Nimick gestured for the pilot to lower the chopper to a stabilized hover and peered at the wooden structure below, Cao Luan's headquarters. There were a number of windows on all sides. He chose one of them as his target and pulled the trigger of his pump gun. The finned CS bomblet disgorged from its muzzle in a train of propellant vapor, punched through the window, and burst open to release a cloud of tear gas. Nimick chambered another round, fired, and loosed a third at the Thai's hideout. Billows of white smoke erupted from the windows. He slung the weapon over his shoulder, he also had an MP5K against his side, donned his gloves, and signaled his companions to the door. A moment later, the rope line was dropped from its hoist bracket. One after another in quick succession, the men gripped the line and fast roped to the boardwalk like firefighters sliding down a pole. Submachine gun volleys erupted on the ground almost the instant they alighted, stuttering from inside the house, from the dwellings around it, and from the wooden walkway that ran the length of the canal. His head ducked low as his teammates laid down a lane of covering fire. Nimick raced around to the front of the hideout. He paused in front of a heavy plank door, sprayed the lock with bullets, and kicked it in with the flat of his foot. With his peripheral vision, he could see Osmar running up on the left. He looked over at him, signaled a crossover entry, and ticked off a three count with his fingers. Together, they rushed forward into the house. General Yusef Tabor, commanding officer of the Malaysian Army's 10th Parachute Brigade, could scarcely believe the orders that had just come down the line. He was to deploy his three airborne battalions, almost 3,000 men, to Sandakan at once and assist the regular Keybank guard units in defending the beachhead. Against who or what it was to be defended was unclear, but he at last saw an opportunity to be a true soldier. As the closest element of Malaysia's rapid deployment force, stationed in Sabah less than 30 miles from the city, his would be the first of the support units to arrive, and that sat just fine with him. After a decade of hunting illegal immigrants like a dog catcher chasing down helpless puppies, it was high time for a mission he could be proud of. Overcome with tear gas, his face tomato red, Cao Luan was uncontrollably retching and coughing as Xiang tried to drag him into the barn. Gripping him under both arms from behind, the pirate opened the door and started to back his way through, but was still trying to maneuver his boss's weight when Nimick and Osmar burst into the house. Osmar thrust his weapon out.
"Hold it, both of you!"
Breathing hard, Xiang stared at him a moment through thick braids of CS gas. Then, still partially supporting the tie with one hand, he whipped the other behind his back and brought a donut-shaped P-90 around on its strap. The burst went wide, peppering a roof support, chewing out splinters of wood. Osmar got down into a crouch and fired back, intentionally aiming low. With Luan between him and the big man, he wanted to avoid shooting to kill, knowing the tie might hold the answer to Blackburn's disappearance. Luan sagged, clutching his meaty thigh, blood spraying from his femoral artery. Xiang tried to keep him erect but was unable to manage it, and he went down with a crash. Retreating into the barn, the pirate triggered his weapon, sweeping it in an arc between Osmar and Nimick. This time it was Nimick who fired back, squeezing off two crisp trigger pulls. Brat, brat! He could hear sporadic exchanges fire out on the walkway, and now and then a groan from one of the incapacitated pirates on the floor.
Cuff Luan and the rest of these bastards. I'm going after him.
Sea spray roiling up behind them, the four hovercrafts scudded over the waves on pillows of air, flanked by dagger-shaped speedboats. They had covered nearly two-thirds of the distance to the beach and would be making landfall within a matter of minutes. In the forward deckhouse of his vehicle, Kursik lifted his binoculars to his eyes to scan the landing zone. He had mustered a force of close to 300 men, outnumbering the Keybank guard by a third, and with the further advantage of surprise. Kursik blinked once, twice. His eyes widened and widened against the lenses of the binoculars. At first, the dots he had seen against the fleecy backdrop of the cloud looked like insects, a sweeping, descending swarm of locusts, but he knew all too well what they were. Paratroopers. Hundreds of them. Thousands alighting on the beachhead. He let the glasses drop from his trembling fingers and ran to the deckhouse radio. But by the time he'd transmitted his warning to the other vessels, the incoming fire had begun. The world was exploding all around him. A blow to the ribcage almost dropped Nimick the instant he plunged through the door. Stunned, Scintillae whirling across his vision, he reeled against the wall of the barn, his MP5K sailing from his fingers. He gulped down a mouthful of air, struggling to get hold of himself, and saw the giant's fist coming at him barely in the nick of time. He rolled sideways, twisting his head to avoid its piledriver force, then slipped a blow as the pirate came charging in at him, his arms raised to get him in a squeeze hold. But Xiang recovered and came at Nimick again. His massive palms clapped down on either side of Nimick's head, his fingers forming a cage around his jaw and cheekbones. Nimick raised his own hands, wedged them up against Xiang's forearms, gripped his wrists, and tried with all his strength to pry them apart. But the giant only held on and began steamrolling forward, carrying Nimick along with him, backing Nimick across the floor of the barn, then ramming him up against the wall opposite the door with an impact that jarred him to the bone. He brought his face in close to Nimick, his features a quivering mask of rage, his breath gusting into his nostrils.
"You want to fight? I'll break your fucking neck right here!"
the pirate bellowed, shaking Nimick, battering his head against the wall.
Right here, like I did to that other American.
Nimick's eyes widened. His heart pounded and swelled within him until its beating seemed to fill the universe. Like I did to that other American. Groaning from exertion, he pushed against the pirate's wrists. Pushed, pushed. For an instant, he thought the pirate's grip would never relent. And then, miraculously, it did. Shoving off the wall, Nimick brought his knee up fast, driving it into his crotch. Xiang's hands fell away from his head. Nimick hit him again, hard to the face with his fist, kept pressing. The giant started to sag, but Nimick didn't let up. He just kept thinking that Max was dead, and this was the man who'd killed him. 2, 3, 4 more powerful jabs, and then Xiang surprised him. He fell forward heavily, lumbering into Nimick and knocking him backward. In that moment, as the two men separated, Xiang lifted his bloody face. His lips twisted into a sneer and pulled his kris from its sheath. Nimick froze, staring at that long, wavy blade. But Xiang didn't give him time to react. The giant lunged forward, the knife flickering toward Nimick's throat. Nimick stepped back a half step, pivoting on the ball of his left foot, and reached out. His right hand caught the back of Xiang's knife hand. His left hand slapped the inside of the giant's elbow, then turned and lifted the elbow up and out. Without pausing, Nimick stepped forward, pulling the giant toward him, and buried the knife deep into Xiang's chest, directly below the rib cage and angling up toward the heart. Xiang remained on his feet another few seconds, looked down at the knife jutting from the center of his rib cage with an expression of utter astonishment, and dropped onto his face. Nimick stepped back, breathing hard, the pain of his wounds rising up within him, and looked down at the fallen giant. It was, at last, over. Just days ago, I sat here and explained to someone how I knew about Marcus Kane's crimes without being able to prove them, Gordian was saying. He placed his hand on the wallet-sized digital recorder on his desk. Now I've got proof, thanks to you. And Max, Kirsten said from the seat opposite him. If not for him, I'd never have gotten it. And to be honest about it, might have kidded myself into thinking nothing strange was going on at Monolith. Gordian looked at her, his frank blue eyes meeting her brown ones. For a while, maybe. But sooner or later, you'd have stopped kidding yourself. And you'd have done exactly what you did. She shrugged. Maybe you're right. I'd noticed a lot of unexplained payments to American lobbyists crossing my desk, sums that went far beyond what they should have been receiving for their services. And as I started paying closer attention to them, I realized they always followed visits to my department head from someone who was with the Canberra Bank in Indonesia. Anyone with open eyes could have seen the money was graft to American politicians. The lobbying group to whom it was going was specifically hired to promote deregulation of cryptographic technology in Washington, but it wasn't until I mentioned it to Max that I allowed myself to see the truth. And it was Max, once you mentioned the unexplained payments to him, who convinced you to snoop around in the computer databases for financial discrepancies. And plant the voice recorder in the corporate communications director's office. She shook her head. It's hard for me to believe how indiscreet they were. I mean, I walked right in there every day before my boss arrived, tucked it behind the sofa, and picked it up every evening between the time he left work and when the maintenance woman came to do her cleanup. Then I'd walk back to my own office and upload everything onto a computer disk before heading home. Went on like that for 2 months. They were quiet again for a while. Then Gordian leaned forward, meshed his fingers on the desk, and looked steadily at her face. Kirsten, I didn't ask you to the States because I needed to have the voice recorder and discs hand-delivered. I wanted to tell you in person how deeply I appreciate what you've done, and also let you know that I'd be honored to have you working for Uplink, wherever in our organization you'd prefer, should you want a job with us. She smiled a little. That's a very generous offer, but I hope you won't be offended if I decline to accept it, at least for now. I'd like some time to myself. Time to regroup. You understand? His eyes were still holding steady on her. Yes. Yes, I do. Is it back to Singapore for you, then? She was quiet a moment, then nodded again.
For a time, anyway. But there's one more thing I have to do here in America before I go.
There it is. You can check everything out if you'd like.
Marcus Kane sat on the leather-cushioned sofa in his study, a square of mahogany wall paneling pulled back on his right to reveal an open wall safe. The man he'd spoken to stepped across the room and peered into the safe. He reached a hand inside, extracted a banded pack of bills, riffled their edges, then put them back and looked into the safe another minute.
"It contains over $1 million in cash," Kane said, "and some trinkets. Diamonds. My dear wife has always loved her diamonds. Worth a great deal more."
The man shifted his gaze toward Kane. He was smallish with a pencil mustache and gray eyes that matched the color of his sport jacket.
"You sure you want me to do this?"
Kane spread his arms over the top of the backrest, tilted his chin up, and laughed, a sound that reminded the man a little of crows.
"What's the problem? Are you afraid you'll screw up the way your friends did at the cryptographics facility in Sacramento? Shall we discuss that merry fucking romp?"
"There's no reason to talk to me that way. Those were tough assignments."
Kane laughed his harsh, cawing laugh again.
"Then let's see you tackle an easy one," he said. "Earn your money this time. And spare me the humiliation of becoming the poster boy for court TV for a year or so, to be followed by a lifetime of prison interviews."
Silence. The man walked across the room, stopped in front of Kane, reached under his jacket. The weapon he brought out from underneath it was a Heckler & Koch 45 P9S. A moment passed. Still standing there, he took a sound suppressor from his inside pocket and screwed it onto the barrel.
"You worried about how your wife finds you?"
Kane straightened, brought his arms down off the backrest. The pained humor was gone from his face, and his eyes were watery. His mouth suddenly tightened.
"Earn your money. Make a fucking mess for her."
The man nodded and cocked the gun and angled its bore up at Kane's head. There was the sound of Kane sucking in air, and then the muted thud of bullets leaving the gun. When his job was finished, the man holstered the gun, walked back around the couch to the safe, and quickly emptied it, transferring everything that had been inside to his briefcase. He paused briefly at the door on his way out, looked at the body and the blood on the sofa and walls, and nodded to himself with satisfaction. "Got what you paid for," he thought. The inscription on the gravestone was elegant, a quote from Wordsworth. "O joy that in our embers is something that doth live, that nature yet remembers what was so fugitive." Reading it, Kirsten wiped a hand across her eyes.
"I remember too, Max. I remember."
Behind her, Pete Nimick waited quietly, standing in the shade of the Japanese maples that grew where Blackburn had been laid to rest, his body flown back from Malaysia soon after it had been retrieved from the grave where Luan's henchmen had left him. Kirsten knelt over the grave, lingering there a moment, her eyes closed as if in prayer or repose. Then she rose, turned from the grave and strode slowly to where Pete Nimick was waiting.
"You okay?"
he asked. She looked at him, smiled a little.
"I will be," she said.
Thank you.
Clancy's Power Plays, Ruthless.com, was created by Tom Clancy and Martin Greenberg and read by J.O. Sanders. It was abridged for audio by John McElroy. The recording engineer was Paul Fowley. The associate producer was Sloan Seamy. Tom Clancy's Power Plays, Ruthless.com, was produced and directed by Karen Perlman. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio. Also available from Simon & Schuster Audio, Tom Clancy's Power Plays, Politica, read by J.O. Sanders.